coming up on Boston Public Radio. Are you going away for the weekend? Frustrated by the 65 miles per hour speed limit in Massachusetts? Well, if State Rep Dan Winslow has his way, you'll soon be driving 70. Legally, that is. Then Callie Crossley joins us to talk who's up and who's down. Vladimir Putin, Apple, and candidates of color in Boston's mayoral race are on the table. Then the Ig Nobel Awards were given last night. We'll tell you who won.
Emily Rooney joins us on the Boston mayor's race and what all of WGBH is talking about, whether Jim Browdy needs a medical intervention after showing up today in a hard hat and asbestos suit because it's Friday the 13th. Are you a basket case too? Then we are the place to unload all your Friday the 13th fears. Plus, our news quiz with the co-hosts of Channel 5's legendary TV show Chronicle, J.C. Monahan and Anthony Everett, coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Happy Friday the 13th, Jim.
And same to you, of course.
Jim's taking off his asbestos suit now.
I haven't yet, but I will soon.
It's a big boy hard hat.
Boston Magazine writes that State Representative Dan Winslow should change his name to Win Fast. That's pretty clever, actually. That's because he wants to bring the state up to speed, literally, by increasing our speed limits on certain roads to 70 miles per hour. In a couple of minutes, we'll get your thoughts at 877-301-8970. But first, he joins us on the phone to explain the rationale behind the legislation. He's a Republican from Norfolk. Dan Winslow, welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Jim. It's great to be back.
Well, I think this is a great idea. I could not be more excited about it. Dan, what exactly is your proposal, please?
Well, the proposal is to take the maximum highway speed limit in Massachusetts, which currently is 65, so any road which has a posted speed of 65, and to make that posted speed 70 miles per hour, unless it's in an urban or a congested area where a lower speed would be suitable, but to take the maximum speed and make it 70. And that's what a majority of states have already done. In fact, Massachusetts is now in the minority of states. Even Maine is, a 75-mile-an-hour speed limit, but to just take the maximum speed. And what's interesting about it is that the Massachusetts Department of Transportation has a guide for cities and towns, because local towns and cities can set their own local speed limits. And the DOT guide says, make sure you don't set a speed that's too unreasonably low, because the public won't listen to it and the law enforcement won't enforce it. Well, that's what we have with our highways right
exactly.
now.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Dan, since you cited statistics, while it is true that Maine is 75 and New Hampshire is 70, virtually all the rest of the New England and Mid-Atlantic states is exactly we are at 65. So who's crying out for this? Are you a solution in search of a problem, or are people saying it's been an issue?
Well, first of all, the Mid-Atlantic states, they're 70, Jim, so it's basically just the Northeast and New York, with the exception of Maine, and then a couple of other pockets. Hawaii, I think, is 60, but, you know, if you go too fast in Hawaii, you're in the ocean. I think what this is a recognition that the road design and the vehicle manufacturer design has improved drastically in the last 30 years when the speed limit was last looked at. And all of the other states have been moving to this 70 or higher. And in that time, highway fatalities have actually come down in the United States.
We have safer cars, and we have safer seat belting and all that kind of stuff. I think
exactly.
that has a lot to do with it.
Well,
don't leave
that issue yet, because on that issue, I actually looked that up today, because I assumed incorrectly that if you raise the speed limit, you increase the number of collisions. You don't. But all the research shows you do increase the seriousness of the collisions, meaning there are more fatalities. There aren't more accidents, more fatal. Well, that's a serious issue.
Here is the thing.
What is it?
You know, Dan Winslow, you've probably not driven in a car with Jim Browdy, but Jim Browdy is the only male I have ever encountered in my entire life who actually drives 55 miles an hour.
No, there are actually two of us. Mike Dukakis
okay,
and I
you
do.
And Mike Dukakis.
That's correct.
And the cars all go speeding by, because nobody drives 55 unless
exactly.
they're like 80. And even though some of those 80-year-olds are driving at 65 or 70, so it becomes a hazard. Everybody's going 65, 70, and 75 in the Mass Pike and 128, assuming there's no traffic. So it seems to me it's safer to have, and also you don't get pulled over and get these astronomical speeding tickets for driving with traffic.
Right, exactly. For our highways, with our cars, our design, 70 is a reasonable maximum speed for the interstates outside of the congested and the urban areas. Obviously, in Boston and Worcester and Springfield and the urban cores, you'd be lower than 70 miles per hour. But there's so many wide open stretches from the South Coast, from the North Shore, and, you know, down the Pike, for example, 495. It would just make sense. And the other thing that's interesting about it is that we all know that the state police and local police pretty much don't enforce 65. And so that breeds a bit of lawlessness where it's just, you know, how fast can you go before you sort of reach the tolerance level of whatever jurisdiction you're driving through? And that's actually more dangerous.
Well, as Marjorie said, there are two law-abiding drivers whom I'm aware of, me and the former governor and presidential candidate. But, you know, the point you made is, I think, the most important one, Dan. The speed limit is 65, which means everybody except me goes 70 or 72. And you know what the question is going to be. When we raise the speed limit to 70, then everybody's going to drive 75, 76, 77, aren't they?
That's a fair point. And the answer is no, because we should enforce the laws that we have. And that's the other part of this. There's a broader philosophical underpinning that's motivating this legislation, and that is that we shouldn't have laws on the books that we don't enforce.
I agree with
that. We should enforce the laws that we have, and not for nothing, but this 65 miles per hour, functionally, it's an unnecessary regulation in our lives. Let's if we're going to have a regulation, let's have one that's meaningful and that we enforce.
What kind of reception are you getting from your fellow legislators and from the Department of Transportation? What are you hearing?
This has already been done, and I think that's the key.
What do you mean it's already been done?
It's been done in a majority of other states.
Oh, I'm sorry. So what are you hearing here, though, I'm asking?
It's not a priority. Clearly, it's not one of my priorities. I filed a proposal, as you know, to reduce the cost of college. You know, it was crickets in the media, but this one's gone nutty. It's kind of hard to predict what'll grab people's attention. But this is just a common sense, simple solution, and my feeling is, this ought to be one of those little tweaks in the law that we make just to keep pace with the facts and to keep pace with the rest of the country.
So for those of us who are with you 150% on this, can we call our legislators?
Absolutely. The House 3175, 3175. And the main number for the State House to call your senator or your representative is 617-722-2000.
And let me be clear, and for those of us who are against this, we can call the same number?
No. The number for that, Tim, is 555.
Hey, Dan Winslow, as always, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan Winslow.
Our number is 877-301-8970. The data that Dan cited is for the most part accurate. New Hampshire is set. Well, I'm sure it's accurate. New Hampshire is 70, Maine 75. The vast majority of the country is let's put it this way. The eastern half of the country is roughly at 70. The western half is at 75. What do you think is the highest speed limit in the United States and what state?
It's 80 someplace.
Nope.
I'm not sure where it is. Oh,
85.
What?
Where
You're
is
kidding.
It? Highest in the United States. Second highest in the world,
Nevada.
Apparently.
Nevada.
Nope.
Where?
Close. Texas. 85 miles
God,
for an hour
figures.
For a certain stretch of roads. And we want to know if you think this is a good idea. And the data,
yes.
Marjorie wouldn't let me get it out, but I'll say it again. I read pretty carefully this morning. I was wrong when I assumed, and I assume this was obvious, that accidents would increase. Apparently, they do not. What is totally clear and a real serious issue is fatalities increase, because when you collide, by definition, at a higher speed, obviously they're going to be problems. So I have to say, I don't see it as necessary
because
let me finish the thought. Well, I totally agree with what Winslow said.
Finish
we
it
should
quickly.
Enforce laws that we Go ahead.
The point is, having driven with you on many occasions, you are a hazard on the roadways.
Never
there
again.
You are going 55 miles an hour. Everyone has to swerve around you. Nobody is driving 55 miles an hour. It's like these little old ladies that are out there with their little old lady friends with the, you know, that you can barely see above the back of the wheel because they've shrunken. You know what I mean? It's so cool.
This is a totally true story. And I've told this to Marjorie before, and I think I've told it on the air. I'm driving on the eastern part of the turnpike where I guess it's 55, but I don't know, whatever it was at the time. And I am the only person who is actually driving 55, except for one other car, a black car. And I have to speed up above the limit because there's somebody on my behind, and I'm worried the guy is going to run into me. So I go to like 58, and I'm also curious, who is in this car
58.
Who is also driving 55 miles an hour? I drive by the car. I look at it. Who waves to me from the back seat?
Then Governor Michael Dukakis.
I wasn't making that up. Dukakis had his driver driving when he was the governor exactly 55 miles an hour.
I thought you were going to say when you get up to the car, because you've noticed this, that if someone is very elderly, and I'm not making fun of people that are older. It happens to all of us sooner or later. You shrink so much that you can't see over the wheel.
No, it's like a
drone.
So
you think that these cars are driving themselves.
That's
when
horrible.
You see these 55 mile an hour cars, or somebody even worse is going going like 50 miles an hour. The point is, you know, 80 is too fast for most places. You begin to feel a little bit out of control. 70 is fine. It's manageable.
But what do you say? Dan agreed with my point about if it's 70, people are going to drive 75. And then he went on to say, and I totally agree with him, if you have a law, you should enforce it. If you don't have a law, then you should repeal it. People are going to drive 75 miles an hour, aren't they?
75 is fine.
Well, I'm not so sure it is so fine.
Well, you wouldn't know because you haven't gone above 55 since 1972 when Jim got rid of the hot rod.
877-301-8970. Dan Winslow, representative from Norfolk, Republican. He ran for the United States Senate nomination recently that Gabriel Gomez wants to raise the state speed limit, not on all roads, but where at 65 it would go to 70. What's your take on this? Let's start in Framingham with Michael. Michael, you're first on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you today?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I'm really glad that the legislature has gotten all the important business out of the way to where we have time for something like this.
Well, in a defense, before you continue, in defense of Winslow, when I asked him, where is this going, he said it's not the highest priority. Reason we talked about it, we're talking about it, is it's a Friday. It is an issue that a lot of people care about. So what's your take on this?
I drive 30,000 miles on the Mass Turnpike every year.
Oof.
It's insane, I know, but I do. And that's because I usually come out from Western Mass. But I do 65. Occasionally, if I had an emergency, I might go to 70, but it's rare. Most of the time, I'm being run off the road and honked at because I'm doing the speed limit. So
that's
the
right.
The limit is 65. And I actually videotaped one day, put a camera in the back so I could see all these people riding up on the rear of my vehicle. Obviously, I must be doing 30, but I'm not because my car says I'm doing 65. You know, you're going to change it to 70. It's really not going to make a difference. The people that are out there that know that there's not a cop on the road are going to floor it and do 80, 85.
So should we do it or not? Where's this leading you? We should change it or we shouldn't change it?
I think that we currently have an environment where it doesn't matter what you change it to, they're going to drive what they want to drive. So it's a waste of time.
Now, Michael,
sorry.
Are you driving in the left-hand lane when those people are coming up in your rear end?
I actually usually end up scooting into the middle lane.
Oh, good.
People
okay.
in the right-hand lane are the ones that are upset that I'm actually doing the right thing in the slow lane, but I never go into the fast lane
okay.
on the left side.
Just checking.
It's Marjorie's pet peeve,
That's my
Michael.
Pet peeve.
You know, Michael,
that
thanks for the call.
It drives me more insane than anything at all. People driving in the left-hand lane when they're not passing anybody. You know what the left lane is for, Jim?
Yes, passing.
Passing.
Earlier this year, I was teaching and I use the term loosely, my younger daughter how to drive, and we had the exact same experience, Michael, was that when I finally took her on the turnpike with some great trepidation, she's actually a very good driver, and I'm showing her how to, you know, switch lanes, this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
She asked me why, and I was driving exactly the speed limit. She said, why is every single car passing us? And by the way, if you drive in the middle lane, which I do, they pass you on the right, they pass you on the left.
You
they don't care what the...
in the middle lane.
Why not?
You should be over in the right hand. Here's what you should do, Jim.
I'm driving the speed limit,
you should have
Marjorie.
Your kid drive. I think you should just sit
now
in the passenger
is.
Seat, and your daughter can drive the car. I think you'd be a lot safer. By the way, there is one argument against my positions from Stephen.
Yeah, fatalities.
Not fatalities. Talking about fuel consumption. It is true.
That's another great point.
You're going to burn more fuel when you're going faster and more carbon dioxide emitted by autos. And that is a good point. It's not the environmentally correct thing to do. But pretty soon, I'm hoping we're all going to be driving hybrids or electric cars. Or
you know, but
like
I met someone yesterday at the Massachusetts Broadcasters Hall of Fame where our great friend Chet Curtis and others were inducted. He just bought a Tesla. Have you seen those cars?
No.
We'll talk about that. Edgar did a piece on they're all electric and they're high-end. They're incredible. Let's go to Mark in Gloucester. We're talking about Dan Winslow's proposal to raise the speed limit in Massachusetts to 70 miles an hour. Hey, Mark.
Hey, ahoy. How are you doing today?
Excellent.
Great.
Hey, good. You know what? Here's the problem, I think. We have one speed limit posted, so that leaves room for interpretation. Isn't this the problem?
What do you mean interpretation?
Well, you know, okay, so you're driving in the freeway and the speedway, let's say 65, and you're right. You have people going 75, you have people going 55. So why not have minimum 55, maximum 75, and enforce it? And if you go over 75, you get the ticket. There's no room for like, well, officer, I was going 65 when it's, you know, like if it says 55 and you're going 65, then sometimes they ticket you, sometimes they don't. It's not clear. And that's why there's a problem, and it's not enforced.
Well, Mark, Winslow only wants it to go to 70. His point is exactly yours. Whatever the law should be enforced, or it shouldn't be there, or else it's an invitation to ignoring it. Yeah, I hear
but
you.
But what about the people that go too slow? Because that's an issue, too.
Arrest them.
I mean, I got news for you.
They do have those.
I'd be in jail for life if
Mark,
that's the...
I have seen, although I must admit I've not seen them lately, and maybe there's a change in the law. We used to see those minimum speed, maximum speeds, you know, where it'd be minimum would be 40 and maximum would be 55. Can you imagine driving
40? Do you see them on
40?
Massachusetts roads at all? I've seen them in other states.
I haven't seen them for a while, so maybe we've changed the policy. But
Mark, thanks for the call.
We should definitely arrest those people. Art has just emailed Jim.
What did he say?
He says that raise the speed limit. People like Jim should get off the road and stay in the T where you belong.
By the way, let me just read to you the states that currently in the Northeast have 65 miles an hour to show that we're not an outlier. Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, and D.C. So essentially, if you take out New Hampshire at 70 and Maine at 75, the whole Northeast from Delaware and Pennsylvania on up is exactly where we are at 65. So what's the big... I mean, I asked Dan Winslow, who's complaining about this? I assumed his answer was going to be a lot of businesses say we want to move our goods faster, we want to provide our services faster. That's a decent argument.
I think there are millions of drivers who would like to be able to go 70 miles an hour.
I understand that.
Miles an hour.
I'm sure there are a lot of things.
They should
be calling it's a good idea.
The legislature right now, 617-722-2000. Stephen has a rather morbid comment.
What do you say?
He says, everyone drives really fast. There will be a bunch of accidents, and we will save the fuel of those people or in the accidents.
Yeah, but it's such a funny thing because, as I say, fatalities go up. You don't need to be a scientist to understand if you're going faster and you have a collision, obviously the impact is going to be greater and the implications are greater. Tom, you're in Dartmouth. You're on with Marjorie and Jim on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hi, how's it going?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. Go.
So, yeah, I just wanted to touch back to that, you know, the fuel consumption and environmental policy point. I mean, for one, Massachusetts really kind of leads the country on a lot of those questions. So I think maybe, you know, it sets a bad precedent to say that we're not going to think about it on our roads. But also, you know, he talks about Teslas and electric cars. Those cars shouldn't be driven above 60 miles an hour or so.
Why is that?
They're really designed.
Why is that?
They're designed to be, because of the efficiency, the faster you go, the less the car is. And so you lose mileage the faster you're going. So if we're encouraging electric cars and increasing the speed limit, that actually makes the electric cars more of a hazard on the road because they're all going to be doing 60 regardless.
They should be going fast.
Tom.
He says it reduces their efficiency
of electric cars. I heard him. But you know what, which I've always wondered, and maybe you know the answer, why do we have cars with the capacity to go 110 miles an hour?
That's a great question.
Why are they made with that kind of capacity?
Maybe it's to suit the macho tendencies.
You know,
of
male
what is it?
It's less about the top speed and more about acceleration in cars how you sort of sense power, but that acceleration ends up to equaling greater top speed. And a lot of cars are, you know, artificially limited because what you're after is that horsepower that gives you both acceleration and top capacity. But electric cars are giving you, you know, like a Tesla gives you a lot of acceleration without that high top speed.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, thanks for the education. We appreciate it. I've never worried about acceleration because when you only go 40, you don't have to worry that much about how fast you get.
Please get on top of this and look up and find out why the cars can go 110 miles an hour.
No, it's a very good question because obviously, I mean, I'll finish your thought. If you decide to pursue the top end, you're violating the law in every single state in the United States.
Correct.
And but isn't there, what's that called, the Autobahn, whatever it is in Germany?
Yeah.
Isn't there only one road in the sort of civilized world that has no speed limit? I think that's, maybe it's 95, I don't know what it is, but 85 miles
95?
An hour. Well, it's 85. I mean, in all seriousness, I occasionally drive over the speed limit. Driving 85 miles an hour is really pretty scary, scary speed. That's the speed limit on major roads in Texas?
But it's not scary if you're the only one on the road and it's a sunny day and there's no one in front of you and no one behind
you.
So you think in Texas
that if other people on the road, people are saying, oh, I can't drive the 85, I should only drive 70 or 60. What are you, crazy?
No, I'm saying that it's not dangerous
if you're alone.
If you're alone on the road.
But most people are not. When you're on a state highway, in all likelihood, you're not going to be by yourself.
Jim, those are big states. You know what I'm saying? They're spread out.
Well, a lot of people,
everything. It's like going across those salt flats in Utah. You know, you're just driving straight. You could go 110 on those, actually.
By the way, in all seriousness, you know that I used to spend a decent amount of time in the Rio Grande because the legal services office was there that I had some dealing with. You literally, the roads are so flat, you can see what appears to be 100 miles ahead of you. Perfectly,
so
totally flat and straight.
Did you go wild, Jim, and
I went 40.
65?
I went 40. I decided to floor it and go 40, 45, throw caution to the wind.
Okay. Let's go to Mike from Westford.
It took me 9 hours to get to the Rio Grande for a 3-hour trip.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Hey, you know, I've had my fair share of speeding tickets and parking tickets and spent a couple of days in court arguing on them. And my view is that it's a money grab, right? The state wants as much money from you as possible, especially Massachusetts. And I just don't see any reality where Massachusetts and the state police agree to, in essence, restrict their power to issue speeding tickets.
And by the way, yeah, right? I don't agree that we're worse than other states. I don't know that to be the case, but you do make a good point. That is a cash cow. Speeding tickets,
exactly.
And they have quotas, even though they deny that they have quotas, I believe. And
you're
right. That's a great point.
Would the city of Boston say, yeah, we're gonna restrict parking, we're gonna lessen parking restrictions. You can park, you know,
right,
in more places where you want to. We're gonna remove parking meters and cut back on these restrictions. Absolutely not. It's a cash cow for the state. I don't see why they would raise that speed limit. It takes away a lot of ticket issuing power.
Can you see? Can you imagine the state showing up at the hearing saying, "We oppose this because, as you know, it is a cash cow for the state treasury." Hey, Mike, fine call. Thank you so much.
We have an answer about why cars can go 110 miles per hour. Art just emailed. Because it's fun.
I mean, it's fun, but you know, you keep sloughing off the danger. We hadn't made the environmental point, which we should have made with Dan. But the safety issue is another kind of question. Let's go to Brighton. Well, we're pretty close to Brighton. Let's go to Jeff. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
My question is, I mean, I guess it's more of a philosophical thing. Ignoring the environmental issues, which I think are big ones,
yeah.
I don't understand why we should be rewarding people who are constantly breaking the law. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, people are going 85, 90 miles an hour on there, and all you're doing is reducing their hazardous driving ticket by increasing the speed limit. I feel, when I'm driving on the pike, completely unsafe, and I'm not a slow driver. I'm driving 65, sometimes I'm even driving 68, but I just don't understand why it has to be that much faster than that.
How about that's a great question. That's for you, Marjorie. That's an excellent question. It's almost like an enabling kind of thing. How about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's like saying, you know, people are doing it anyway, so we might as well make it allowed. It just doesn't jive with me philosophically.
Yeah, I guess I guess because I don't feel unsafe at all in a big car, which I probably don't need anymore. But I do have a mid-size.
I'm SUV.
A mid-size car. It's a hybrid, I should point
out.
Yeah,
it is a hybrid.
But anyway, I don't feel unsafe going 75 miles per hour. I feel unsafe with people going very slowly. That drives me crazy. And people driving in the left lane, blocking everybody else who's trying to get by them. I don't feel unsafe.
Hey, Jeff, thank you for the call.
Do you feel unsafe? Why do you drive so slowly? Why
do
you drive so slowly?
I mean, I am actually a pro safety kind of person, and I think, by the way, I don't drive slowly. I drive the speed limit. That is not slowly. That is the maximum. It's the opposite of
That's
slowly.
That's why you do it?
It is the maximum speed limit.
Because you're a pro safety kind of person?
I am actually a hugely pro. Now, the problem, as I said before, you know, I do NECN is in Newton.
Mm-hmm.
Some days it takes me all afternoon to get from Boston to Newton, which, I admit, that's a problem.
Well, you missed your show 1 or 2 days a week, Jim.
In any case,
no big deal.
If you want to weigh in on this, Dan did make the point. You can call 617-722-2000 and tell your legislators how you feel about this issue.
When we come back, Callie Crossley joins us for her take on the Boston mayor's race. That conversation is next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And joining us in Studio 3 is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. It airs every Sunday night on WGBH 630. She is Callie Crossley. Hey, Callie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Thanks for sitting in for us yesterday. We heard it was great.
Yeah,
it was good.
It was much fun with Christopher Lydon, I heard, too.
Yes, absolutely.
So you, Vladimir Putin, as people know, wrote this op-ed, very controversial, in the New York Times about the Syria crisis, telling us that we are not exceptional in the United States of America, claiming that Assad didn't use his weapons, but he's going to give them up anyway. So what do you make of this, Callie?
Well, I, I went to a different place when I read the op-ed. I'm like, how did that get in there? That was my whole fate. That was my whole focus. I wanted to know because, you know, what normally we're in the business, so we know that normally if people write op-eds, either the newspaper reaches out or you send something in and hope they pick it up. So I'm thinking, Vladimir Putin's calling in. I got an op-ed. That was my whole take on it. I mean, I got the content. I read that and got it all.
Yeah.
But I was really interested in that. And
but you don't think
out,
the New York Times is wrong to publish the thing?
No.
Well, you know how it
is. I interrupted you.
I don't think a lot of people know. It's Ketchum Public Relations.
Yeah.
They're huge. They're international. They have a multi-million-dollar deal to promote Russia. They have a website they maintain called thinkrussia.com. I mean, these are all fascinating pieces of information to me. And apparently Putin wrote most of it himself with a little addition. They didn't do it.
You know why I buy that? You know, there was a piece either in the Washington Post or the New York Times yesterday saying, addressing just that. Did he write it or did some Western PR firm write it? And the writer of the blog on, again, I think it was the Washington Post, came down on the side where you are, is that it seems that Putin did it. Because when you read this, the infamous line, it is extremely dangerous to encourage people to see themselves as exceptional. The whole rest of the editorial was to try to create space between the American people and their president.
Right.
Between that was like, and by the way, you people in America who think you're exceptional, which a lot of people do, you know what, you. I mean, it was really a slap across the face kind of thing. So my guess is the guy did sit down,
at least
color this thing to a great degree.
I think he did. And then apparently they had some of his, you know, minions to help weigh in on it. I thought the best line about all of this I heard was on Joe Scarborough's Morning Joe, when Joe said, well, this is fascinating since he's linked to killing journalists and now he am one.
I thought, wow, okay.
Yeah, it is odd to get a lecture from a guy like Putin who came up in a very, was sort of nefarious
KGB
way
boy.
Through the KGB.
But you know, but
also
just...
they said it was huge, the response. Well, Angelina Jolie, remember that when she announced how she did the double mastectomy preemptively to avoid getting a breast cancer, the response to this was like huge.
Absolutely. Well, nobody expected to see Vladimir Putin with an op-ed in the New York Times. So I think that's the first thing. And then it came at a critical point because he gave the rebuttal that I'm sure Rand Paul would have liked to have given to get that much attention. So there was a lot of interest in it. And then I went to my favorite polling, the only poll I ever believe, which is the AOL poll. And it's by now, 51% of the people who weighed in and checked on the AOL said they believed that what he wrote represented the view of the rest of the world, which is pretty interesting. Or a lot of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So I thought that was why people were interested in it. And I think half of them were interested, as I was, is how did it get in there as well.
Well, you know, we had Andrew Bacevich in from Boston University.
Was it Friday or Monday?
I think it was Monday when he came in. And he did say, if we are concerned for the moral issue here, or we're concerned about the humanitarian suffering in Syria, how is sending more bombs to these people helping them from a humanitarian perspective? And I thought that was a very
well,
good...
Well, in all fairness, I thought he was terrific. Putting it in the context of history since 1980, when he says it's, quote, a vast illusion to believe that we can do anything to bring order to the Middle East through military methods. Without that history, I think he could answer his question by saying, well, if we essentially degrade, to use the most overused word of the week, his ability to use weapons of mass destruction or even conventional weapons on his own people, that's a step up. But then when he puts it in the context, though, everything we've done over there has not led to the outcome we wanted. It's pretty powerful stuff. You know, the next thing you wanted to talk about, I am obsessed with. Mm. I have a droid. Marjorie has an iPhone.
Yes, okay? I do.
And finally, they come out with two iPhones this week, the cheap version, allegedly the cheap version, the plastic one and the other one. What happens?
The stock drops 5%. This is pretty amazing. And I'm beginning to believe it's, you know, people are in the I'm over it Apple thing. Now, they've got iPad.
You should create a website. I'm over it. That is a great one, but go ahead.
But I think that, you know, iPad's going to hold up for Apple for forever because everybody loves it. Though I am surprised to see a very aggressive ad by Microsoft on TV. I don't know if you've seen
it.
They compare the iPad features versus the features that they have on the Microsoft and say, hey, we're cheaper and we got all these other things. Get over it. Get all the features. That's what a lot of people are saying with regard to your owning a droid. There are many other features I can get. It lasts longer. You know, all of these things. And why should it be so expensive? And by the way, these new iterations of the 5 and the 5C and the CS and whatever the hell all these new plugs. You had to switch over to a new plug, which really angered a lot of people.
Well, you know what I take out of this is that first of all, Tim Cook, who is the new Steve Jobs, and I use the term very loosely in this case, he replaced him, makes $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year as the CEO of Apple. I would say that it's pretty clear, one, he's not earning it. That's not that anybody deserves $1 billion a year. But the second point is this, is we like to think, most of us like to think, that nobody is irreplaceable, despite our sense of ourselves. Steve Jobs is totally irreplaceable. Yeah. It is clear that Apple was Steve Jobs, and that's not to take away from the brilliance of the engineers and the artists, but this guy was what drove this company. And I'm not sure it's survived. Well, obviously it'll survive. I'm not sure it'll ever be Apple again without him.
Well, you have a sense, given what we now know about Steve Jobs and his, you know, heavy hand in a positive way for the company, that I don't know that they would be coming out with these little increments, these little incremental thing for the 5CS. Just stop it and come out with 6 or whatever. I mean, it's just annoying now, and it's really expensive. So I have a 4S. I was not at all moved to even watch the keynote. I used to watch the keynotes. Mm-hmm. I used to get into it. But look, let me just say this about Apple, because they're laughing all the way to the bank, as you've mentioned in one way. The other reason that the stock dropped was because they did not announce what had been an anticipated deal with China Mobile. And if they get that deal, which is supposed to happen, that's 700 million new subscribers. They don't care what we think.
But you know,
let me just speak
to the move to the Droid. You were talking about the content comparison, which a lot of people did. When I was getting a new phone, I guess maybe 3 months ago, I did that comparison because I had a Droid, was I going to switch to iPhone? But part of my thing was not just the comparison, which came out a little bit on the side of the Droid. It was also sort of an anti-Apple, subliminal maybe, I don't want to be like everybody else. And it turns out, I was stunned when I see the numbers that there are more Droid purchasers now than there are iPhones. I don't think it's just because the Droid is allegedly a better phone. I think people, what was the expression you used?
I'm over it.
I'm over it. I think there's a lot of I'm over it in this country now.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, though.
What's that?
Steve Jobs was a visionary.
Mm-hmm. You read the book,
didn't I read you? The book. He was a major jerk of a person, even to his own children, but clearly just a genius in what he did. And staying up until for 2 days in a row, figuring out if the T should curve a certain way on the keyboard. I mean, he was absolutely obsessive, and I think that's a rare quality in a guy. I mean, it's like Bill Gates. I mean, they don't come along that often.
Let me just say, my if I was on the board of Apple, which I've not been asked to be, I would say the most you can make Tim Cook is maybe $975 million a year, because it really, I mean, can you believe for a second, and I don't mean this as a criticism of him, the fact that anybody's salary. It's one thing if you start a business and we just learned that what's his face, the Samuel Adams guy now is the new billionaire,
yeah, right.
Jim Cook. But he made his money, and I'm not defending or criticizing. But to get a salary of $1 billion a year, particularly when you're not the initiator of a company or the founder, it's just to me is an obscenity.
One last thing I will say, because I just finally bought my first Mac computer this week, one of the little AirBooks I've always had.
She's now in the heaven, by the way.
No, I'm in heaven with the Mac Air myself.
That's what she got.
But it's not just that. When you go into the Apple store, you do get great help from these people. They still kept the service. You may have to wait a while for it.
The geniuses are fabulous. I love those geniuses.
And after I bought it, I was there for about 45 minutes. The guy showing me this, showing me that, showing me the other thing. Of course, I've forgotten it all already.
But you can go back. That's the great thing about it. And the other thing about it is I had the pleasure of meeting a head genius, which I didn't even know they existed. Like when they go behind the door and say,
there's the genius
of all geniuses.
Really?
The man behind the curtain. By the way, they prefer to be called genii when there's more than one of them, Kelly. Hey, Kelly, Marjorie and I don't know if you know this, Marjorie and I are huge, huge train of files. We both love train travel. If it weren't for time constraints, everywhere we go, whatever we're doing, she'd go, I'd go, etc. There's a new train thing that is happening, and I am wildly excited about it, and I think you are too. Yeah,
yes.
What's the deal?
Well, I was so pleased to read this week. If this would be a story under the radar, actually, if we were doing that subjects this week, we're doing a special one, as we'll talk about in a minute. But now there's a new, and it's not even proposed, it's happening. Right under our noses, our legislators, our business people got something done and approve this. And so it's an unused piece of track between the Seaport District and downtown in the Back Bay area. It's going to take 2 years, which is really not a whole lot of time.
On existing track, as you said, that's the most amazing part of this.
I just can't. And they're going to be using diesel. I mean, it's all everything 21st century happening. And so they're going to have regular transportation between the Seaport District and Back Bay. I got all excited and warm and fuzzy at the thought of, oh my God, I can get the tequila right there on the waterfront and ride back. No driving. This is great.
You know, and the traffic coming from there normally is horrific.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I'm embarrassed to say I can't pronounce the last name. The woman who was the business editor of the Globe, who now is a columnist, Shirley, is it Lung? Is that how you say her last name?
I don't know.
Her first, not her first, one of her first columns, she just became a columnist maybe 2 months ago, was about how there's about to be gridlock in the Seaport District. The good news is the development's colossal. It's a beautiful part of town. I mean, you go to Legal Seafood and those kinds.
Oh, it's great.
Wonderful.
It's so beautiful, but there's going to be gridlock. And then lo and behold, maybe 10 days later, we hear about the train thing. And I'm wondering, was that in the works? Was that provoked by her?
I don't know.
You mean about their telling us?
Saying there's going to be an economic disaster there because you can't get in and out in a couple of years.
Well, apparently this had been passed on, approved and everything, and it didn't take all the other ya-ya out here in the public that generally slows up these kinds of projects because the tract was there and because
That's
other
great.
Things were in place. So it didn't really have to pass through 99 levels of I think so, I don't think so. So I don't know if she knew this was coming later or whatever, but boy, everybody, even the Karmaloop guy who doesn't, is not too swift on Boston right now. He's saying this is the greatest thing.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be wonderful.
You know what's great? Two of the feel-good stories. I hate that expression. I don't know why I used it, but I'll say it again. Two of the feel-good stories of the last 6 months are both train-related. This thing, which came out of nothing on existing track.
And the Cape
Cod? And the Hyannis thing. Have you done it yet?
No, and I'm dying to.
I don't know when it ends. It's over.
I think it ended on Labor Day. Oh, I could be wrong.
The fact that it's happening is spectacular.
I know, that's a wonderful thing.
Kelly, we have, I think it's 11 days to go, which is amazing. Only 11 days till we narrow 12 to 2, obviously, in the mayoral race in Boston. You have a particular interest in this and angle. What's that and what are you talking about on Under the Radar?
As you know, on Under the Radar, we look at stories that not a lot of time and attention has been spent on them. And we also try to lift up various perspectives that perhaps have not been discussed. So our whole focus this Sunday is about the mayor's race, but we're going to look at it from not only the historic import of having half the candidate field be candidates of color, but also we're going to talk about identity politics, whether or not there's a difference or maybe some lessons to be learned in what happened in New York and what could possibly happen here in Boston, whether anybody in the lower tier, which mostly are the candidates of color right now, seems to be gaining some momentum and could maybe have an upset. All of these kinds of questions, plus a lot of other stuff to consider, including, while we're all concentrated on the mayor's race, and that's important as we look at this, there are two candidates of color in the city council races who are Asian American. And I believe that their election and the campaigns around them, both Michelle Wu and Suzanne Lee, in fact have some impact on what's happening in the rest of
Suzanne Lee is the woman who lost by 97 votes to Linehan, who was in the news this week, obviously, because of the whole issue about Linda DeDorsey-Nafori. Now she is, but not emceeing, at least if he had his way, the St. Patrick's Day breakfast in South Boston.
You know, I'm certainly not the first person to say this, but John Barros has been very impressive to lots of people who've seen him in action.
Yes.
A young guy, I think he just turned 40, had another baby this week.
Yeah.
I did not know he was a big organizer for Obama within 495 and 128 and stuff, and has done a lot of work identifying voters. Peter Galzinis in the Herald has got a great piece today with Barros talking about how he has ID'd this whole group of voters that he says he's going to get out on Election Day.
And
so
it's about turnout for sure in this one.
Yeah, it's totally about turnout.
Are we talking 12%, 11% in these latest polls? Big piece in the Globe today saying even the strategists can't figure this one out because it could go in any number of directions. So that's our conversation with two folks who are very insightful. And
who are they?
Peter Ubitaccio from Stonehill,
From
Stonehill College, as well as Kelly Bates, who is the new executive director of the Civic Engagement Center. At Emerson College.
Where my daughter just started college, by the way. Kelly's terrific. You know, the one statistic, which I'm sure you know, I mentioned this in the air the other day, that I don't know if I was shocked by, but I found it to be jarring. It was New York Times talking about people of color running to be the executive of a city. I think the statistic, I'm pretty sure I have it right, is of the 25 five largest northern cities in the United States, only two of them have not had a mayor who was a person of color, Indianapolis and Boston. Right. I was stunned. 23 out of 25 of the biggest cities in the North have had a person of color as mayor. And well, obviously, we're not even...
Actually, Ken Cooper wrote a very detailed piece about that very fact for the Boston Globe magazine a few weeks back, noting, you know, with some that people would be surprised by that statistic.
Yeah. Well, we are very tribal in Boston. You know, you have, I mean, you have had, was Tomanino not the first Italian mayor? Mm-hmm. I mean, we have had Irish Catholics running Boston for ages and ages and ages.
We're not so good on the woman front either in Massachusetts. Not only in the city, but in Massachusetts.
And look at the three front runners again, in terms of money anyway, are John Conley, Irish Catholic, Dan Conley, Irish Catholic, and Marty Walsh, Irish Catholic. And you get huge voting blocks in South Boston. You get huge voting blocks in West Roxbury. And, you know, it's so important in Boston to vote, because when you drive around the city of Boston, where's the nicest... parks. Where's the nicest housing projects?
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, they
well,
are
always
in
people
South
in every city.
Boston.
People who vote get a response.
But it's like, you know, it's like night and day.
You know, you mentioned, I don't know, did you say the projected vote? Did you say a minute ago, to get it wrong, they're saying 12, 15?
Yeah, 15.
You know, the notion in a city which has a history of having mayors serving a long period of time, I mean, where, you know, you can go back the last, obviously the last several, not just Tom Menino. And the fact that most of these candidates are quite young, which means it's not impossible, they'd want to serve for another 10, 15, 20 years. The fact that a huge percentage of the city is not going to turn out, particularly since you have 12 choices.
Yeah.
You can't do one of those, well, they're all the same. There's nobody who's good. I mean, you can't have 12 choices, the vast majority of whom are competent adults who have done decent things, and try to say, there's nobody who I respect enough in this race to be the next leader. If it is a 12 or 15 or 18% turnout, people should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, you know, one of the things that we're going to touch base a little bit on is on Under the Radar, too, is that Chris Ferrone has actually been writing about this for some time, about how the talent in the candidate pool is so rich that
it is
sad to think, you know, we're going for one gig when, you know, he imagines a whole cabinet where all of this talent could be spread around.
Well, especially
the city.
Since a lot of them are going to lose their jobs.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the other part. Exactly. What happens next Tuesday?
That's right.
Is four? How many city councils running? Five, six, whatever.
Well,
it's likely it won't be Charles Yancey.
It's likely that four. Yeah. Right, exactly. Since he's running for both. You say that to Charles Yancey, the first two words out of his mouth are Joe Lieberman, who, as you know, ran for the U.S. Senate and Vice President.
But you got to love Charles. He's so charming. You know, you have to.
Let me tell you, he's a fighter. I mean, the guy's been around a long time, and he's a fighter.
And he's done a lot of favors, yes, constituent service-wise, for a lot of people. That's going to be very interesting to see the vote for him, especially among elderly people who've been helped by. He's been there for 30 years.
Yeah.
That's a lot of favors for a lot of people.
Hey, Callie Crossley, we'll be listening Sunday night. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Callie Crossley is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can catch her show every Sunday night at 6:30. Okay, up next, what happens when you put a bunch of Nobel laureates, opera singers, and hundreds of paper airplanes in one space? The Ig Nobel Prize Ceremony. It happened last night. We're going to find out who won up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Researchers at UMass Medical School in Worcester announced they'd found a way to shut down the extra chromosome that causes the developmental problems of people with Down syndrome.
Higher education impacts everything from our economy to our ability to remain a world leader.
We were fortunate to get funding for high-risk, high-impact work.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Stana Stairlifts, whose stairway chair lifts can make it easier and safer to get up and down stairs. You can learn more at stairliftboston.com or by calling 1-800-UPSTAIR. And Celebrity Cruises. You can embark on a culinary journey with onboard dining in up to 12 distinctive restaurants, globally influenced classic and contemporary menus. Details at 1-800-CELEBRITY or your travel agent. Ships Registry, Malta.
We Welcome back to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. In case you missed last night's 23rd Ig Nobel Awards ceremony, we're bringing you the abridged version by way of the man responsible for it. That's Mark Abrams. He's the editor and co-founder of the Annals of Improbable Research and the originator and MC of the annual Ig Nobel, it's hard for me to say, prize celebration. Mark, it's great to see you.
Okay, so for people that haven't heard of these things, please explain to us what the Ig Nobel Awards are.
They are awards. They're prizes. We've done them every year since 1991. Unlike almost any other kind of prize, it has nothing to do with good or bad. These are for things, anything, that first makes people laugh and then makes them think. These are all real.
And we were Edgar B. Herrick III, our colleague, was there last night. He was raving about the ceremony and every single part of it. He said the actual Nobel Prize winners, not Ig Nobel Prize winners, Nobel Prize winners in many cases give out the awards to the winners of your thing?
That's incorrect. It's not in many cases. It's every case.
Is that true?
We have 10 prizes. And we had, let's see, we had 21, I think, winners, because some are teams, come from five different continents at their own expense last night. This was all in secrecy. The winners are announced on stage. And we had four Nobel Prize winners who shook their hands and physically presented them with their Ig Nobel Prizes.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I saw these two guys in mouse suits. Were they?
Those were two members of one of the teams of Japanese winners who had flown
so
in.
So those are those two guys in the mice suits were Nobel Prize winners.
No. They were winners of the Ig Nobels.
Okay. Just want to make sure.
And what did they win for?
A little undignified for
they
Nobel
win?
Prize.
I don't think it's undignified at all. I think the show. What did the people in the mice suits win for?
They were two members of the team that won the Ig Nobel Prize for medicine this year. That was for a study they published in a medical journal which assessed the effect of listening to opera on heart transplant patients who are mice.
Who funds some? I mean, I have to say, I'm embarrassed to say I find that interesting.
That's the journalist's first skeptical question.
Yeah, and who does fund this? It, yes.
In this case, I don't know. It's irrelevant to us. Uh-huh. Many of the winners are people doing this on their own. Mm-hmm. Many are things that it's difficult to see why someone would do it, but of course that's why we choose them, so you can look. Many, it's difficult to decide whether it's important or not or a good idea or not. Some of these are things that may turn out to be important that happen to be also goofy. There are many things that are like that.
Tell me, this one I found particularly entrancing, about the probability prize. Tell us, please, about the probability prize. You get that there in your notes? If you don't, I have it in mine.
Yeah, also in my memory. This is a team of scientists based in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And they published a study, which you can go and look up. Their study describes two related discoveries that they made. First, what was that the longer a cow has been lying down, the more likely that cow will soon stand up. Their second discovery was that once a cow stands up, you cannot easily predict how soon that cow will lie down again.
Okay.
I was going to do research.
Why does anybody want to know that?
I'll tell you that in a second, but I'll mention the team member who flew over and accepted the prize told me afterwards that it was only when we offered them the prize that any of them realized that what they did might seem funny to people.
Why?
Really?
Because in their world,
that's what they do. They're professors at a veterinary college outside of Edinburgh, and they work with cows. That's what they do.
Well, you brought
so
in the award. You were kind enough to bring
in the field, waiting for the cows to stand up.
No, you don't have
and
to
lie
stand
down.
There. You can lie down yourself or sit if you
I
want.
I suppose that's true. You can lie down yourself.
Brought the actual award. Can you describe it to us? The recipients of the Ig Nobel Prize. What did they get this year?
I'm holding it. It's a beautifully made thing. There's a man named Eric Workman who works at the Museum of Science who makes these. It's a frame under glass. Inside there's a hammer, and it says Ig Nobel Prize. And there's a sign saying, in case of emergency, use hammer to break glass.
Think about that for a while, people. The hammer is under the glass. I think you get it now.
So, Mark, these are obviously, if you have Nobel Prize winners flying in from four and five
countries. No, we have
continents.
Ig Nobel Prize winners flying in. The Nobel Prize winners sometimes fly in, but many of them live here.
Okay, many of them live here. That's what I was wondering about. So the Ig Nobels are the ones that are coming.
One of them, however, and this happens every year at the ceremony, that in the middle of the ceremony, we have the Win a Date with a Nobel Laureate contest. Each of the 1,100 people who've gotten a ticket and are physically there inside Sanders Theater has a chance to win a date with one of those Nobel Laureates.
And who'd they win the day with?
It wasn't they. It was only one person who won a date.
Who did the individual
win? Roy Glauber, who has a Nobel Prize in physics.
It's unbelievable. We're talking Mark Abrams, who's the man behind the Ig Nobel Prizes.
It's unbelievable. That sounds like the statement of a disappointed person who had hoped to win the date.
Maybe, you know, had I known about it, I would have hoped to win the date. Uh-huh. I also read in the last 24 hours that there's at least one person who won an Ig Nobel who went on to win a Nobel Prize. Is that true?
Or That's right.
That...
In the year 2000, we gave the Ig Nobel Prize in physics to a scientist named Andre Geim, who is now working in England. And he and another physicist got their Ig Nobel Prize because they used magnets to levitate a frog. 10 years later, Andre Geim was given a Nobel Prize in physics for doing something else, for a discovery of – there's a substance called graphene you may have read about. It's the two-dimensional form of carbon. It's sheets one atom thick. It's actually there are millions of layers of this inside every pencil, but nobody had ever been able to tease apart those layers. They don't come apart easily. Andre Geim did that. Because he did that, scientists now are able to study how this stuff behaves, and most of them are convinced this stuff is going to become immensely valuable and transform electronics, how things are measured. It's the strongest and lightest substance anyone has ever found. It conducts electricity in ways almost nothing else does, conducts heat in ways. And this is the big glamour substance, and it's all due to Andre Geim discovering this.
Now, Mark Abrams, before we get back to some more of the prizes, virtually every one of which is – this sounds brilliant. Well, I think scientifically brilliant as someone who was not very good in science. Me.
They're not all science. There's the Peace Prize, remember?
Well, let's get to the Peace Prize in a second. 1,100 people, I was stunned when you said this a minute ago, show up at Sanders Theater, beautiful Sanders Theater at Harvard. Is this – what's the breakdown? Are these people who want to get to laugh? Are they science-oriented people? Who shows up at this thing?
The audience is the greatest mix of people I have ever seen. Just to give you one, some are scientists, some are students, some have nothing to do with science. There are people who fly in from other countries. One of the people in the audience who I talked to is a nun, and in fact, a nun from one of the few places that still wears habits. And she showed up wearing her habit, as she always does, with a stack of paper she had brought to make paper airplanes to throw at the stage, because there's a tradition that that's what the audience does. They throw paper airplanes at the stage. Because of that, because of all those paper airplanes, we have to have people on stage with mops sweeping the stage, or it's a practical problem, or else we cannot walk
around.
Where
was the nun from?
Connecticut, but originally from France.
That is a great story. We're talking to Mark Abrams, who is the man who is behind this. Was the 23rd Ig Nobel Award ceremony last night at Harvard.
Mark, how did you come to be behind this Ig Nobel ceremonies? How did this happen for you?
In 1990, I became the editor of a science magazine. I started meeting people who'd done all kinds of really odd and funny things. And I kept thinking, it's a shame. Most of these people go their whole lives and no one, hardly anyone, will ever know they existed or what they did. Somebody ought to do something for them, something small. And then realize, well, you know, I can do something small. And we started these prizes, started the ceremony in 1991, and it just kept growing.
You know, I want to get to the peace thing in a second. Just that, before you get to that, Marjorie, I have said to Marjorie, I don't know how long I've known Marjorie, 15 years, 18 years, whatever. I've been saying to her all those years, I want to know what you can do with a dead shrew. Haven't I said that to you? I just don't know what to do.
What a coincidence
really,
this is.
It's unbelievable. So I read that one of your prize winners, I believe, did do something with a dead shrew.
At what point during this relationship did you get married?
We didn't. That's one of the reasons, actually. So
you've,
what
you
is
married
the,
well.
What was the dead shrew thing about? What was that about?
This Mark? Was a prize. We decided to categorize this as the archaeology prize. Mm-hmm. And it went to two scientists who parboiled a dead shrew and then swallowed the shrew without chewing it.
Wait, how big is a shrew, first of all?
big enough.
Like a so, mouse.
Yeah, it's
right?
about mouse size.
Yeah, okay, mouse
so
size.
They swallow it. They parboil the shrew. They swallow
they swallowed it without chewing.
Yeah.
And then carefully examined everything that was excreted during
sure.
subsequent days.
To what end?
They did this so,
so
they
to
could
speak.
See which bones would dissolve inside the human digestive system and which bones would not. What they discovered, yeah. they expected that all of the big bones would pass through. What they discovered is that's not true. A lot of even the big bones get dissolved inside the body. This turns out to be scary to a lot of archaeologists because a lot of archaeologists, they dig up old things, old bones, and from the bones, they figure out, oh, I can tell you what this creature or these ancient people ate. And they assumed that the bones passed through. All those assumptions are wrong. So a lot of archaeology is probably wrong. That's what these guys discovered.
Oh, my God. The T-Rex does not look like we thought the T-Rex did.
But that's a serious thing. So
it's not so much what it looked like. It's what did these things eat?
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. I gotcha.
All bets about that are off now.
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny because I had parboiled a dead shrew a couple of years ago. I was thinking of swallowing it whole, and I didn't. And else I could have won something the other night.
Just quick one question about the T-Rex. Mm-hmm. So we always figured they ate people and other animals and other dinosaurs.
If you figure they ate people, you're pretty wrong because they were
and
they
other
were, they
other dinosaurs, other dinosaurs, and they were meat eaters.
I don't know offhand.
Tell us about the safety engineering prize.
That was awarded to a man named Gastano Pizzo. It was awarded posthumously, and we talked to his living relatives about this beforehand. They were quite happy with this. He lived in either Queens or the Bronx. He got a patent in 1972 for an electromechanical system to trap airplane hijackers. Mr. Pizzo's system drops a hijacker through trap doors in the plane, seals him into a package, then it drops that encapsulated hijacker through the airplane's specially installed bomb bay doors, whence he parachutes to Earth, where police, having been alerted by radio, await his arrival.
Can you believe this?
So why is this that? Why, considering a hijacking
a
was a real,
idea.
Obviously, serious problem, and obviously it led to a very serious problem as recently as 12 years ago. Why did nothing ever happen with this? Is this functional, or was it functional?
Too expensive.
Or no? Really?
Too expensive to install.
You had to make sure the hijacker was correctly positioned.
Yeah. You know, that was one reason anyway.
How do you find it? Do people apply for this thing, or do you search them out? How does this happen? How does someone win one of these bids?
We're always looking, and we is international, but we anybody can send in a nomination. We get something like 9,000 new nominations a year. Consistently, 10% to 20% of all those nominations are people who nominate themselves. Mm. Those people almost never win.
Oh,
why? Because they've heightened.
If what you're the main thing you're doing is trying to do something with this quality that both makes people laugh and think, you're going to fail. You're almost certainly going to fail. This is almost always just a side effect. For example, the cow thing,
which I thought was a riot.
The scientist who did that last night told me that it was only when we offered them the prize that they realized what they had done might seem funny to other people.
I love that. By the way, that's my favorite thing you've said all today. I love that they take this seriously.
Well, before we move on from the cows, yeah. I mean, so these are people, you said they were it's in Scotland, correct? Uh-huh. And they're sitting or standing or lying down out in the field with the cows, mm-hmm. timing, I guess. I mean, did they do this for months? Did they do this for years? I mean, it is incredible to think this is what you do all day.
It's months. Well, there are different ways you can set up cameras and things, too.
Hey,
that's true. You,
you mentioned before, and I interrupted you, that the Peace Prize is not all scientific. Your version, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize, went to who and why, Mark Abrams?
The Peace Prize this year was awarded to Alexander, I want to get his name right.
Lukashenko.
Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus.
I knew that, yeah.
Because he made it illegal to applaud in public.
Mm-hmm.
The prize was awarded jointly to him and to the Belarus State Police because the Belarus State Police arrested a one-armed man for applauding.
Okay, now there's a fairly obvious question that goes with that, yeah. So why don't I be the one to ask it? So what was he slapping his leg? What were the facts?
The one-armed man?
The reports are interesting to read.
The reports in English, anyway, they almost all tell what happened in the courtroom, that the police were very embarrassed about doing this. The judge was very embarrassed, but the guy who's head of the country wanted this done.
And so this
man was hauled into court
and
convicted.
Yeah, he always says.
And we don't know how he was applauding. That's a mystery.
He says he wasn't applauding at all. He's got one hand.
I think he's got a pretty good defense in that. So
not in Belarus, sir.
Now, if people can't get enough of this, and I can't imagine that anyone could ever get enough of this, what's the website?
Improbable.com. There's lots of detail. You can see video from the whole ceremony last night, improbable.com. And tomorrow afternoon, Saturday afternoon,
yes.
Most of the winners are still in town. They're giving free public talks, 1 o'clock at MIT. And just look at our website, improbable.com. It's free.
We're going to come next year. This is great.
You must have a blast doing this every year. I mean, this is just a riot.
I enjoy my work.
Yeah, the bra that was turned into a pair of gas masks, that was pretty good, too.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a riot.
I feel like I really missed the boat on the dead shrew. But yeah. That maybe another time.
Just describe the bra really quickly.
Yourself.
The bra...
If that's what it takes to save your marriage.
Yeah. The bra was a cone-shaped
Yeah, that was Dr.
Deal.
Elena Bodnar,
yeah.
A doctor who grew up and was trained in Ukraine.
Uh-huh.
She treated a lot of victims, especially children, when the power plant at Chernobyl melted down. That's why she started thinking about this. She was trying to come up with a way to, if there's an unexpected emergency, have some kind of filter that people could put over their mouths so they wouldn't breathe in these radioactive particles. That's what does the medical damage, most of it. And she realized years later that any group of people, half of them are wearing a nice piece of cloth right around their chest. And you could, if you design it slightly differently, you can design it so it unhooks in the middle and you've got two face masks, one to protect your life and one to protect the life of some lucky bystander.
By the way, I am working on a conversion from briefs, boxer briefs, to gas masks, and I'm hoping to submit that
There's
next
no
year's competition.
There's no need to do that because years later she came up with a version
she did
for
not.
Men. It is not the same design you're describing. It's different.
Well, in any case, Mark Abrams.
She has a company that makes these things.
Is that so? That's rather frightening. Mark Abrams, great to see you. Congratulations on the 23rd.
Thanks for having
Mark,
me here.
Mark, that was very funny. Mark is the editor and co-founder of the Annals of Improbable Research and the man behind the annual Ig Nobel Prize celebration. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Innovation Hub, we examine the challenges of paying for healthcare and one ubiquitous solution that's probably within arm's reach.
I continue to see the trend of prescribing lots of apps and very little in the way of medications, relatively.
I'm Kara Miller, a prescription to cure our healthcare system, this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 on WGBH Radio.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It is Friday at 1 o'clock. It is open mic, and it must be Emily Rooney, and it is. Welcome, Emily.
Hey, Marjorie. Hey, Jim.
Hey
well,
there.
First of all, congratulations for your mayoral forms, because they're not easy to do, and you've done them all week long. You've interviewed every one of them, correct?
No, well, not quite.
One of them didn't show. Yeah. One of them stiffed me, but I actually got a voicemail today from someone in Hingham, which I really appreciated. She said, We watched every single one of them. We were watching all week, and we feel really informed. And these people aren't going to get to vote.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point,
yeah,
isn't
like,
it?
Oh, yeah. Hingham, that's a very good point. Yeah. And you actually had some humor at last night's debate. Well. So what's your do you have?
Wait a second, you're leaving all these things lying. You said she said one of them didn't show up.
Charles
you don't
Clemens.
Ask her who it was.
Charles
okay,
Clemens,
Charles Clemens.
The radio host.
After saying he would, at the guy who runs the illegal radio station.
Yeah.
And
well,
you also really. Just said it was very funny last night. Then you move
well,
on. Why was it funny last night?
You were talking about geese. Tell us your question.
Actually, it was Marty. Well, I did this nuisance segment. Nuisances around the city of Boston. And I've got a list a mile long
of
nuisances.
About
yeah, what a surprise. So I decided to change it last night because I'd used some of the same ones for some of the other stuff. So I said one of them was, what are you going to do about geese and geese poop on the Esplanade, the public garden, the Boston Common? So I turned to Marty Walsh and he starts talking and then he stops and he just says, I have no idea. It's like, I have no idea what to do.
One honest
I
man
thought he was
crowd.
Going to give a shovel to Felix Arroyo to go down and clean it up.
So what's but your takeaway? I know you put a huge amount of energy, you and your staff, into this thing. So
they were great.
What's your takeaway
I
from
really,
four
really
nights of this?
Like five or six of these people, and any one of them, I think, would be a good mayor.
You don't mean just like them personally. You mean you like them as candidates to run the city.
I like what they had to say. I like their leadership qualities.
Who?
I think that's a little unfair.
Okay. And you do get to vote, unlike the person
from
Hingham. But there was also a piece of this that I know drove you over
just
the edge a little
bit. Edge.
And I have some of the same concern in other elections. What is it?
Well, we try to do the right thing in the news media for the most part. Most mainstream outlets try to do the right thing and include everybody. You invite them. If they made the ballot, should they be included? I think I'm done with that. We have to have another threshold because anybody can get on a ballot. One of the candidates went out and bought signatures, so
which
he
is perfectly
get on the
legal, but it you
is.
Can do
I know.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
But he was disheveled, disengaged, dirty, had nothing to say, wouldn't shake my hand, and I'm not the only person whose hand he didn't shake. I heard from somebody else at a major media outlet. He came in, she extended her hand. She was going to be moderating the forum, and she had to withdraw her hand, and then she said, "Well, I just want to ask you a few questions." So I can introduce you. And he said, you want to ask me a few questions? I mean, this is...
Was he a germaphobe or was this some sort
he's
of
filthy.
Disdain?
Yeah, but you know,
well, he couldn't be a germaphobe because he's a walking, carrying germ himself.
Well,
my
good you're not naming names.
No, now, I'm not naming names.
I know you're not. Now, Emily, you know, I have the same concern, always have. I've done a decent number of debates as you have. The problem is this. In most settings, I mean, I used to be of the purist school where you include everybody if they made the ballot. But the problem is, as you say, you can buy signatures. Yeah. Or in lower, you only needed, how many signatures did you need in Boston? 500? Some pathetically low
very,
number.
Very
I forget
low.
What it was. But in any case, the problem is this. In most races, this was sort of an aberration. Most races, you really can tier people based upon polling data, based upon money. If it turns out you did it on money in this race, you'd basically exclude virtually all the candidates of color, except maybe Gola Ritchie and Arroyo. I may be missing one. And if you do it by polling, it's ridiculous because
there's
at least the polling I've seen, everybody's within the margin of error, except maybe Wyatt. So even though I agree with you, it was almost undoable in this case.
There are other thresholds, I think,
like
you can use. Well, involvement. Whether there is a campaign, whether they've got an email, whether they have a website, whether they want to engage. You can tell who wants to engage and who doesn't. So you don't. Why are we forcing people to engage who don't want to? That's what I feel like we've done.
But there is a lot of talent in this race. I think people
there
in
is.
Boston, if you pay attention in the next few days, if not already, I assume a lot of people are already, there are a lot of talented politicians out there.
Every place I've gone recently that people know that I've met all the candidates or interviewed them, they come running up to me. I had some guy stop me in a tennis court the other day saying, you got to tell me who to vote for. And then he was saying things like, oh, yeah, I heard an interview on NPR. And then he starts describing, and I'm ticking up, was it so-and-so? And then he says, I really liked what he had to say. And I said, I'm going through all the candidates. He said, I don't know. He had no idea.
Well, you know,
that
is part of the problem. I mean, the reality is all the people were entitled to be on the ballot who are. But because of the fact there was no vehicle for people like you and other people who did debates or forums to winnow the field, in many ways, while you're doing a service to small-D democracy, you're doing a disservice to the voter.
Definitely.
Because the vast majority of people, unless they're embedded, for lack of a better expression, or really wildly excited about one of the candidates, it's very hard to distinguish these people.
Extremely
even
hard.
If you watched all of your debates, even if you watched the NECN thing the other night, which had all 12 of them there, it is really hard. And so I guess the reason I say that is while you and I may sound undemocratic, un-small-d democratic, when there are too many, I don't know what too many means. When there are a huge number of candidates, it is very hard for people who actually have jobs and lives to distinguish between
people. And they're
people.
Not all on television, you know,
with ads,
ads
and things.
Which sometimes gives you a sense of who they are. So it's – and half of them, you know, state city council. Oh, it's the city – oh, it's that city councilor. Like, well, there's four of them, you know.
Yeah.
It's like,
before you say – I know you're not going to name names. I don't think that's perfectly fine. No, it is. I mean, you moderated the debates. It seems unfair if you did. Have you decided who you're voting for?
I have.
And you're not going to tell us why, but – well, I mean, you're not going to tell us who.
How about first
but tell
initial?
Us why – no. Or say it backwards, and we can do like the John –
Paul
McCartney.
Number
nine.
Year after but, you leave. But you know something
else? Wait, no, I don't want to leave this yet.
Sorry,
tell us, without giving it away, what caused you to decide that this man or this one woman is the person – I mean, I don't mean as a joke. I mean,
I
what were the things that got you there? The most grown up, the adult in the
I'm
room,
not
a leader?
I'm going to say there's a loyalty factor and leave it at that.
Oh, you mean you have a personal thing?
Loyalty factor.
Yeah, loyalty factor. But, you know, I do find that there's
just mulling that one
trying
over.
Trying to figure that out. You could talk, Marjorie, while I figure out who she's talking about.
I think I know. I suspect. But, you know, I think a lot of people who have kids in the Boston public schools are quite engaged. I mean, I think that they are really looking for some changes in the Boston schools.
I hope you're right, Marjorie.
And I had the sense. Well, just I was just in talking around and calling friends of mine that do have kids. I mean, that's a big deal in Boston.
But let's keep in mind the vast majority of kids in Boston public schools are what? Kids of color.
That's
they're
right.
minorities.
87%.
And
that's right.
The candidates who have raised the least money. And who at least, I'm not citing these polls, but at least anecdotally, who have the steepest hills to climb are in many cases the minority candidates, the candidates of color.
I walked into my door last night. I was running out to go someplace else. I took three phone calls in the space of 12 minutes.
From campaigns?
From campaigns. And one was actually, there were a couple were robo calls, but one was a real call. Actually, this is sort of funny. It was Marty Walsh campaign. And hi, this is from Marty Walsh campaign, Jim. I said, hi, Jim. I said, well, actually, I'm a reporter. I said, so I can't really answer your questions. And he goes, Emily, is this you? And then I got a call from a pollster. So
yeah.
They asked, they gave you a list of 10, what are the 10 most important things facing the city? And they gave you a list and you had to pick one. And then they asked you who you were voting for. I didn't answer that one. But
there
you know,
was a long poll.
So I think it's a poll
A couple of my friends have gotten long poll, like
I mean,
10-minute polls.
Media, I think there's a media outlet in the field. I would guess it was probably the Globe. So we should have a poll in the next few days.
You know, we should also say the Globe is not editorialized yet. The Herald has.
They
picked
will.
The two well, I assume they will. I don't know otherwise.
Oh,
I assume
yes,
they will. But the interesting part, which was rather unusual, is while they emphatically and powerfully embrace the two Conleys, obviously both spelled different ways, they did something that doesn't happen that much in editorials. They went out of their way in the second to last paragraph said, but there's one, don't vote for him at any cost. That'd be Marty Walsh, because they can believe, at least the Globe.
That was unfair.
I tend to agree with that, by the way. And here's the line from the thing. And that brings us to a rare anyone but non-endorsement. State Rep Marty Walsh, who continued to lead the Building Trades Council, that's part of the labor movement, as business manager even while sitting in the House, has given ample evidence that his loyalties remain with his union supporters, not with city
taxpayers. Where is he giving ample evidence?
Well,
that's not fair.
Well, in his defense, Walsh did raise his hand about charter schools at the meeting the other night about teachers, which
how much it
the
upset
Boston,
the teachers' unions.
He is off the reservation with the unions on schools. But, you know, I mean, I don't think it's unfair. This is the Herald's.
That's their MO, I know.
We are very anti-exorbitant pensions in state government and city government. So
public unions.
This is a guy that represents those interests.
Yeah.
And even though he has courageously differed with the Boston Teachers Union, thank God, because if the schools don't get better, nothing's going to get better.
You know, before
Boston.
We leave the mayoral thing, I just want to say, you know, it would be a great project for all of us to be engaged in, and our bosses and our colleagues. This whole issue of what we're we shouldn't use the word fringe. Well, you did, so I started
fringe.
Too. Fringe can. It is a serious issue in terms of our the obligation people have in the media to be the conduit to let you know who your candidates are. I have done debates where there are people you almost feel.
Barbara Johnson. People are in La La Land.
Remember, she was a heavy smoker and she had one of those cigarette voices. And those were in the gubernatorial debates.
Well, how about the libertarian woman who ran for everything? What was her name?
Grace Ross.
No, not Grace Ross.
Oh, my gosh.
Carla Howe.
Small government is beautiful.
Like, so how do you feel about the budget crisis? Small government is beautiful. What color is the sky? Small government is beautiful. And remember she sang on her, remember she sang her song that she wrote, Marjorie?
She didn't like the media.
On our radio show, Small Government is Beautiful.
She
had a very nice voice. In any case, it's something we shouldn't let drop after next, through next Tuesday. But that's when this thing really gets exciting. It's been narrowed the tooth. There's been a mayor for 20 years. And as of a week from Tuesday, we're
I'm
down
hoping
to two
there's a
candidates.
Poll out in the Sunday blow because that will really win. It,
oh, I'm sorry.
I said
I misspoke. A week from Tuesday, of course. Yeah,
it'll give you a sense of, you know.
Yeah, but can I tell you something? I know this is, will be ridiculed for this, but I'll say it anyway. If the poll shows that essentially everybody, maybe with the exception of Wyatt, is within the margin of error, what's the point of the poll? To say someone is a front-runner, and then, you know what Brian McGorry said to us when he was with us, the editor of the Globe, last a week ago Wednesday, he was here Wednesday too, but he said they've gone out of their way, and I commend them for this, even though they've done some of the polling, they will not tier candidates. They will not put candidates in tiers,
they
because
can't.
When you have a poll, when the top guy is at 12, and I think the bottom person was at 3 or 4,
so
which is within the margin of error, you can't do it.
Whether the Globe will do full-bore profiles on every individual, if you follow me, because they've been doing them since the last week in August, and they did John Conley today. I think there's maybe two left.
I mean, will they do all 12 candidates?
Yeah.
I am 100%. I can't imagine them deciding that a couple of people don't deserve a profile.
Have they done David Wyatt yet?
If he, maybe he's not even cooperating.
Yeah, I wondered, because I don't think I've seen a profile of him yet. It's a week from Tuesday.
Yes. Week from
so we
11
only have 11 days left to go.
You know, so let's talk about another race for a second. There's a story in the Globe today. A trepidation remains over Martha Coakley. The conventional wisdom, which she has not confirmed, is that next week sometime she's going to announce her candidacy for governor. And the point of this piece by Frank Phillips, the lead State House reporter, is that there's still a lot of residual bad feeling in Democratic circles. I hate this kind of story. But,
I know, but it's...
But it may be over her loss to Scott Brown. And the term that Frank uses, who I think is a great reporter, he says, party leaders and activists who have not yet forgotten her, and these are his words, not quoted, disastrous performance. You know, I am one of the few people, I think... It's sort of like when people say Charlie Baker was the worst candidate ever.
It's not true.
My take was he wasn't a horrible candidate. Deval Patrick was an incredible candidate.
Yeah.
Same Scott Brown was it was the perfect storm in many ways.
It
he was the 41st vote. He was charismatic.
Against
people
Obama
were sick of Democrats. Coakley wasn't, you know, the second coming of
she won
but she
the
was
primary by 20 points.
Against
remember?
Some pretty
she made
tough
that
guy.
One gaffe, you know, standing outside
Park.
The
Fenway Park.
But that was
nothing. And she says to me many times that she certainly goes to the Red Sox games and knows that Curt Schilling was a Red Sox player and not a Yankees player or whatever the mistake that she supposedly made, everybody made fun of her about. I mean, it was just a piling on. I remember this, Scott Brown, and this is significant, from 7 o'clock in the morning when sports radio began.
Yeah, sports radio.
Until the end of the day at 7 o'clock, everybody that people listened to coming in and out of Boston was on the Scott Brown bandwagon. You were madly in love with Scott Brown yourself, Jim.
I was not madly in love
yes,
with
you
Scott
were.
Brown.
It was a,
he
it was
called
a
our
bromance.
Show a lot. I appreciate that.
It was a
that.
Bromance of unbelievable proportions. Every time Scott would text, Jim would get a little lilt in his step.
Oh,
you could
goodness.
See his expression change.
You're absolutely
every
right.
man in Massachusetts was in love with Scott Brown. Either they wanted to be him or they wished he was the varsity kid they talked to in high school. So it was a very unusual situation.
Do you remember my interview? I've told you this. My first interview with Martha Coakley after she lost the race on NECN, and we did her on the radio too, but I don't remember if she said this there. I said, what's the one thing you'd change? And she said, I'd call talk radio. And,
yeah.
and you know, because
one
they wouldn't necessarily put her on.
Well, no, I think they're not going to keep her on. And let me tell you, my experience in talk radio with some dramatic exceptions is a lot of the most outspoken, violently critical crazies on talk radio, hosts I'm talking about, become paper tigers when the person they're criticizing actually enters the lair.
Yeah.
And that's
but the minute
the way,
they're gone, they're back at it.
That's also so. What, does she? The reason I even brought it up, Emily and Marjorie, is does she, the second she gets in, become the favorite on the Democratic side above the Grossmans and the Kayems?
Yes,
Kayems and everybody else.
I think she does.
Does she?
Well, Frank Phillips seems to think so. I mean, she's certainly got better name recognition than any of the
yeah,
others.
She does. I mean, I think that Martha Coakley, I mean, this is not anything unique or original out of my mouth, but that she has got the same problem that every former attorney general and Middlesex County prosecutors had running for office. They have these extremely impressive records. They're toughest candidates. They're not naturals. Tom Riley was not. Scott Harshbarger was not.
Frank Bellotti.
Frank Bellotti.
Dan Conley.
Dan Conley. That's right. So it's difficult for her. But I think there's a lot of, you know, women have not done very well statewide in Massachusetts. And I think a lot of us feel bad about that and would like to have more women in public office. And I think one of the big things about Elizabeth Warren was kind of a hangover from people feeling bad that Martha Coakley was so ridiculed, I thought, unfairly after she lost.
You know, speaking of fair or unfair, when Charlie Baker announced he was running, Emily Rooney was on our show, mm-hmm. and we broached the possibility that Charlie Baker would run against Martha Coakley, and Emily described the race as follows.
That would be a fascinating, you know, pair up, you know, the two kind of like profound losers going against each other. Well, seriously.
Profound losers. Look on her face.
But on the other hand, look at how, I mean, this is a woman, Martha Coakley, who was ridiculed on Saturday Night Live.
I
mean, it was a national Let's Make Fun of Martha-a-thon, and she went back to her job,
yep.
and she's done very, I mean, I am upset that she has not gone after these state troopers to find out what they were doing down there.
The
young man that was killed down in Orlando.
We're going to be asking her if she gets in, right, Jim?
Yeah,
I think
that's a very bad move on her part. She should have done that. But, I mean, she's handled herself incredibly. I mean, I might have been teetering on the top of the Tobin Bridge after that roasting.
I think she was devastated by it, but, you know.
You know, before we leave this topic and we get to the thing that we're really here for in a couple of seconds, just for a second, because we were talking about fringe candidates, you have Steve Grossman is announced. Dan Wolf, the founder of Cape Air State Center, sort of in, sort of out. I don't know what his status is. Juliette Kayyem was with us the other day. I know she's going to be with you next week, Emily. Don Berwick, who ran Medicare and Medicaid for Obama, is
Joe
here.
Avalone.
Well, that's what I was going to. Joe Avalone, most of us never heard of.
Yeah.
Joe Avalone, when you read his bio, Joe Avalone is a fairly major player in the healthcare industry. He may have been a low-level elected official in Belmont. I can't remember. So you decide next week, I want to have a really early debate on Greater Boston with the Democratic candidates.
No, I would include them. I know where you're going with this.
Why?
Because they're unknowns. My point about the threshold is once you get to know what somebody has to offer and it registers a zero, you get to take them off the list.
Fair enough. Okay, now this is why you're here. It's the only reason I showed up today. Here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
You know, I say this every week, but I want to say it again.
Every time I hear
it doesn't
that.
Matter how many times I could play it in my car all day long.
We should get the MP3 so I can listen to it at home, my computer.
Okay, this is time for what you get every Friday, roughly 120, Emily's list.
This
take it away.
This is from my you can't make this up list. All right, so did you guys see this? Talk about too much information. In Ladies Home Journal, Lee Woodruff, who's married to that incredibly handsome Bob Woodruff, you know, who was injured in.
Yes.
The title of the thing is something like "Why I Never Want to Have Sex with My Husband Again" or something. It is the most unbelievably graphic, specific. Marjorie's like horrified. I was too. It's like why I'd rather go to sleep than have sex. I mean, and then she's...
Wait a minute. Is it because she's tired or because she doesn't find him attractive anymore?
What, she's done with it after 40 years of marriage. I can't make that. Everybody's going to turn off the radio and run and go get this magazine. It's like,
First of all,
I didn't want to know.
Yeah.
I just don't want to know. And she's like, oh, Bob's not on board with this. Well, it's like, okay.
She's been married for 40 years?
I don't know if it's 40, 30 maybe.
Wow.
And then, of course, the other end of the spectrum is Sheryl Crow, who we both saw last night on Piers Morgan. It's all she wanted
to
talk about.
Here's another one you can't make up.
Go ahead.
Do you know what EGO is? E-G-O. It stands for something.
No.
All right. EGO, Eliminating Government-Funded Oil Painting. I swear to God, I did not know this. All right. Did you know that almost every elected official in the face of the earth gets an oil painting? An obscure EPA administrator. His cost, $40,000. Condoleezza Rice's portrait was $52,400. And former Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, $51,000. So EGO wants to eliminate...
I'm with them.
Eliminate government...
Take a picture.
...funded oil painting.
Yeah, take a picture. Really.
You remember?
I'm getting on board. I'm sending them a check tomorrow.
So here's a quiz that relates that. Who has the only oil paint portrait of former governors in which he is dressed totally differently from all who came before? Marjorie, you have the answer.
Bill Weld.
Bill Weld. Why is that?
I think he's in an Adirondack hunting
suit. Oh, no. He's in that Adirondack
hunting
suit.
He's in jeans. I know he's in jeans.
He went to that enclosed park and was shooting wild boar that couldn't get away because they were enclosed in a fence.
Five by five foot park. Oh.
Yeah, I can't even talk about that.
Okay,
all right,
next.
Moving along here.
Yes,
remember
fine.
How outraged I was about that bear cub they shot out of the tree
sure,
last week?
Yes,
yeah.
And you were right.
All right, I want you to know I've got my priorities straight.
And you went and did research
oh,
after
I did.
The show
big
to prove
research.
That they were lying about what they were saying.
Totally lying.
Go ahead.
This probably even tops
Am
that.
Am I going to cry?
Did you see this story?
No.
This is in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. Police, a SWAT team, took out a 107-year-old man. Because he was in a standoff because he didn't want to go back and live with his son-in-law.
107.
They came bursting into the house with a SWAT team and took him out. And I want you to know, they took him out. They got him. They got their man.
And what's her?
What was his crime?
At the time. It was a
few
days.
He wouldn't leave the house?
But there was more to this. What was the explanation? What was their explanation as to why they did this?
He shot first. Okay. He shot first. I mean, come on. I know. I can't even.
Oh, my God.
All right.
It is pretty horrible.
Did you see
isn't
this
it?
One?
Yeah, 107?
Right. This is still from my. You can't make this up.
Then he fell out of
did
a tree
you see
after
this?
That. It's horrible. I'm sorry.
Out of Reno, Nevada.
Not.
Go ahead.
The Reno Gazette Journal.
What happened there?
Printed this obituary.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Ann Teresa Johnson, born died August 30th. Survived by 6 or 8 children, whom she spent her lifetime torturing in every way possible. While she neglected and abused her small children, she refused to allow anyone else to care or show compassion towards them. When they became adults, she stalked and tortured anyone they dared to love. Everyone she met, adult or child, was tortured by her cruelly, an exposure to violence, criminal activity, vulgarity, and hatred on behalf of her children, whom she so abrasively exposed to her evil and violent life. We celebrate her passing. It was real.
That is great. That is truly.
Hey, is you know, great. They got to get back
All
at
right,
mom.
I have one more thing here.
We're ready.
Yes, it's fine. It's
no,
fine.
Jim, take your time.
You know how I was very, very complimentary of your pepper grinding skills?
Yeah, a lot. And I mean this sincerely. I probably got as much feedback from that as virtually anything we've
okay,
said
well,
on the
air. Marjorie wasn't here that day.
No, but he's really
I have
grinder.
A new presentation.
Okay.
You do?
Last few days, Jim has been. Well, he used to have this. I happen to know it was a legal seafood bag, but it's got this. It's made out of old sails, and it's got a blue little crab on it. Well,
yeah.
Apparently, something happened. He spilled
his
SpaghettiOs
some crap
in there
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So this week he's been using a garbage bag or a shopping bag. So, Jim, on behalf
business.
Of everyone here on the Boston Public Radio staff, I want to present you with this real man bag.
What is this? Oh, you are kidding!
No.
Is this true?
Yeah.
Is this real leather?
It's a real man bag. Just leave it at that.
This is a beautiful, it looks like leather. Maybe it's pleather. But it is a beautiful leather.
You can put your
what
stuff
is this
in
about?
There.
Nice.
Look at the lining here, too. It's got a beautiful plaid cloth. There's got to be.
I know some men who used real man. My father was a man bag man.
This is, so what's this about?
This is for real.
You're
That's
right.
All.
He's
this
got that little
so
plastic
you.
Bag from the Star Market.
That is really
doesn't
nice.
Look, doesn't, for a man of
it's
your
It's for all of our sake.
That is real. Yeah. Oh, because the other stuff was offending
I mean,
a
here's
bit.
A 6-foot guy walking around.
Five
a,
to you, thank
six foot
you.
5 with
whatever,
a you know,
yeah.
blue crab on his. It didn't work for us.
It's a little dirty too, and I know right. obviously. No, don't go away because this is on a series. And by the way, I love that, and thank you. It's very kind of you. In a couple of minutes for our quiz this week, the two contestants are the host of Chronicle for 23 years and his new co-host of just a few months. Both were big fans of both of those. But what it got me to thinking was, of course, you know, and you're a Channel 5 alum. Who the first host of Chronicle was decades ago, mm-hmm. more than 30 years ago. And, of course, it was Chet Curtis. Marjorie and I were off yesterday because we went to the Mass Broadcasters Hall of Fame, of which you are a
I'm
member, by
to
the
go,
way.
But
oh,
I
you're
can,
an inductee.
Yeah, I am, yes.
And Chet was honored in one of the most moving ceremonies as one of the maybe dozen, Susan Warnick, some others, maybe dozen people who were admitted. And I have to say, his presence, his speech, the standing ovation he got that had to last for 5 minutes.
Oh, it was the biggest
standing
ovation
one of the most powerful, beautiful
seen.
Things I've ever seen. And the reason I bring it up is because we haven't had a chance to talk to you about Chet, and I know you work with him forever. I just wanted to get your thoughts on a day like this.
You and I have talked about Chet many, many times, and working with him, it was just like he was the same guy on the air as off. He was full of humor. He was a mentor to everybody in the room. I'm acting like he's not with us anymore. I mean, this is a guy that everybody loved. I mean, everybody in the newsroom and still do. I mean,
you know what's unbelievable? I didn't meet him long after I'd been watching him on television for ages. And the first night we went out to dinner together, he'd get stopped on the street, Mick Jagger-like, by the way. I mean, literally, virtually every 50 feet. And you know what the most amazing thing, which says more about Chet than you can possibly say from just watching him? Well, normally when you meet a celebrity, you start asking them a lot of questions. What Chet would do after a second is start asking the person who stopped him everything about them. Where are you from? Where do you work? Do you have kids? And at the end of the conversations, you'd see the look on their faces like, I can't, not only can I not believe I met this icon, but he treated me like a peer. It's just
one of
the sweetest, most talented people ever.
You know,
and by the way, everybody, for people who don't know, he's suffering from pancreatic cancer and he's fighting like crazy and he has great days and not so great days. But for the most part, he is it's amazing how well he is doing under unbelievably adverse circumstances.
But one last thing that many people didn't know about him, and I didn't know about him until I happened to be out one time at an event in Quincy with Chet Curtis. He has got the most gorgeous voice.
Oh, yes.
We
all knew that.
I
heard him sing.
You heard him at Channel 5. I didn't hear
Christmas
him until
parties,
much later, and he would sing with that a cappella group.
He's a serious singer.
Yeah, he's
first time he was
voice.
Ever on radio or TV, I just learned this last few days, as a 15-year-old in upstate New York where he grew up, was as a singer. He sang. It was, and he said he tried out. He said it in his speech yesterday for Arthur Godfrey's talent something or whatever as a young teen. All I want to say is if anybody ever deserved, in addition to you, Emily. Emily was inducted a handful of years ago.
You were?
Yeah, 2009.
For you.
If anybody deserved induction in the Massachusetts Broadcasters Hall of Fame and any other, the Human Hall of Fame, one of the most wonderful people I've ever met, and we wish him the best of luck, and I'm pretty convinced it's going to work. So in any case, Emily, thanks. It was great.
Thank you, too.
The way, I've seen three of your four forums this week. They were spectacular.
Thanks.
Did a fabulous
job.
Go
over and ask her who she's voting for while I introduce
She's still trying to figure
segment.
It out, please.
She's loyal.
Okay.
We'll see.
Okay.
See you, Emily.
Emily joins us every Friday at 1 for Open Mic, but you can check in with
thanks
her on
Thanks for the gift, too.
7 o'clock on Greater Boston. Up next, we're going to be joined by the two co-hosts of Chronicle, the long-running news magazine on Channel 5, J.C. Monahan and Anthony Everett, co-hosts of Chronicle, in a duel over this week's headlines, up next on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Marco Werman. We're tackling all aspects of the potential military strike against Syria, from the debate at home.
There's a large number of anti-war progressives, Democrats who are liberals, didn't vote for Iraq, won't vote for this.
To opinion abroad.
This is one of the most polarized issues dividing the opinion of our Arabic audience.
Our Syria coverage continues next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Roger Williams University, presenting oceanographer Sylvia Earle on September 25th as part of the President's Distinguished Speaker Series. You can find more information at rwu.edu. That's rwu.edu. And Fox Hill Village of Westwood, providing retirement living to active seniors for over 20 years, which now includes White Oak Cottages and its new concept in memory care. FoxhillVillage.com, WhiteOakCottages.com.
Can we reinvent learning when academia is a field steeped in tradition?
The accountability movement is sweeping the nation, and I'm very glad that it has come to Massachusetts.
Under the new plan, MassBay will see a 16% spike in state funding next year.
Listen for reports from WGBH's Higher Education Desk on campus with reporter Kirk Carapeza on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and New England Audi dealers, presenting the new 2013 Audi A8 TDI clean diesel model. You can learn more about Audi TDI clean diesel at newenglandaudidealers.com. That's newenglandaudidealers.com. And Masterpiece, World War II may be over, but Christopher Foyle's war against injustice and wrongdoing rages on. All new episodes of Masterpiece's Foyle's War premiere Sunday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio and our weekly news quiz. Our contestants, we're pretty excited about this week. Our co-hosts of Chronicle, we were just talking about the first host of Chronicle, the great Chet Curtis, a couple of minutes ago. The current hosts are, one has been with WCVB for 23 years, last 8 is host of Chronicle. He gets his hair cut where I do at Anthony's and at Alfred
and
Harvard Square. My apologies, I had a little brain thing there. He is Anthony Everett. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Your hair looks lovely.
Thank you very much.
You're
I'm actually
welcome.
On my way there to get a trim, just so we know we can throw another plug in there.
I said Anthony instead of Alfred. Can you believe this? I've only known him for 30 years.
Times I have to do this.
That's pathetic. And the new co-host and one of the most beloved figures in Boston television of Chronicle would be J.C. Monahan, who's been there since May of 2013. J.C., it's great to see you.
Nice to see you in person.
Now, let me ask you something. You walked in the room. You said hello to Marjorie very warmly. You said hello to me very warmly. You did not even say hello to Anthony. Should I assume there's already tension on the set? Is that what we're saying?
Is
that...
This is a competition, right?
It is a competition.
All right. Well, I didn't know that I was supposed to be warm to the competition. Hello, Anthony.
She's going for the jugular.
That's right. Which I think it's because I know I'm going to go down in flames. So, you know, I'm just trying to intimidate from the other side of the table.
It's okay. Most everybody gets everything wrong. Don't worry about it.
So how is this? You were sole host for off and on for a while. And all
for
of a sudden,
3 years after Mary left. That's right.
You have this woman sitting next to you. How is that? How's that gone down?
It's
for
as icy as you just saw. I mean, I got to turn the AC off in the studio just to keep it at a nominal temperature.
By the way, you guys are great. In all seriousness, we were talking about this morning. It looks
great.
You guys
have
been great together. It's a great show. 7:30 is obviously on Channel 5.
I'll tell you what, I will say, I've said all along, ever since Mary left, that it's really a two-anchor type of show because there's so much participation of the correspondents in the show that you need to talk about that afterwards. So it's really nice to have JC there and to have a co-host that we can talk about the various things we do on the show. So it's worked out great. Worked out great.
And Anthony knows I love him.
Silence in the room. Okay, fine. Shall we get started? Why don't we do a boy, girl, girl thing? Why don't you ask questions of JC, and I will take care of Anthony here, Marjorie.
Am I starting?
You are.
Okay. Here is Governor Deval Patrick talking to reporters earlier this week, and the question is, JC, what's he talking about?
I just heard about that, and I'm just, I mean, I didn't know it was going to happen, and I'm just, it's just dumb. I mean, the timing could not be worse.
9/11, the prayer in the Concord School.
Well, actually, you got
a
half
steal?
A point
for Logan.
That.
Logan, that's Logan. Right. She got it. What was the prayer in the Concord School?
They did the Muslim prayer on 9/11.
Instead of a moment of silence.
Sorry, so I thought that was it. But yes, Logan, when they had the same day, got the 9/11 part, and they had the drill.
You know what was unbelievable? I don't know if you picked up on this, Marjorie, but the second that JC, she got the 9/11 part, the second that she got a syllable out that may have been incorrect, did you hear what Anthony Everett said? Can I steal the question?
Can you explain what it was?
That
at Logan Airport on 9/11, which of course two of the four planes flew out of Logan Airport on 9/11, that they did this fire training exercise and there was a lot of smoke and flames and the governor was saying it was just dumb, as you just heard him say.
So at the end of half of a round, J.C. Monahan has a sizable lead of 1-0 over the great Anthony Everett.
The point is, I have a lead.
Exactly. That's Anthony,
right.
Here is your question. You ready?
Yes.
Good. Who is this man and why is he in the news this particular week?
When I would travel around when sometimes things got a little dicey on the campaign and I'd go to a subway stop or I'd go to a concert or a church service, sometimes people would come up to me and they'd wrap their arms around me or they'd pull me close to whisper in my ear, they'd take my hand and they'd say, "Don't quit."
Well, he didn't have to quit. Who is that particular person, Anthony Everett? Look at her. She is raising her hand also to steal the question. Who is that person?
Clearly, it's Anthony Weiner.
That is exactly.
That is correct.
Came in fifth.
Yeah, he didn't do so well, Anthony Weiner.
Hung in there as long as
he did
is an embarrassment.
Well, I didn't say it. You said it.
You know, his wife, Huma, was not at the concession speech. What do you make of that, JC?
I think it's about time.
Yeah, I think she may have come to her senses. You know, you see her and you think, what is she doing?
You know, but that is a great question. That is a great question. Was it Lawrence O'Donnell? What was the line that he used on MSNBC when he had him on the other night? Like, what are you doing or what are you thinking or... It's totally
true. He went out with grace and dignity, sneaking out through the back door of a McDonald's to avoid the woman that he was sexting. And then the nice one-finger salute
yes,
to
did.
The rest of the media.
If you think Anthony's making this up, it's all true.
All true.
Yeah, and do you recall the name of the woman he was sexting that showed up?
No.
Sydney Leathers.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
She just had all the physical, what do you call it?
Yes, she did.
You know,
she
implants.
Had some things
she's
done.
Yes,
she
yeah,
did.
She, yeah, yeah, implants. Okay,
okay, it's 1-1. Second round, Marjorie right. for J.C. Monahan.
Okay, I'm warning you. This is a hard question, J.C., so
great.
Don't feel bad if you don't get this one right. People leave their hearts in San Francisco. Here's Mayor Tomenino talking about what they do in Boston.
They stole my heart.
They stole my heart.
Here's okay, the question.
My heart.
What is Mayor Menino talking about?
This is hard.
They stole my heart.
No, they didn't steal. They stole my heart.
Sorry.
That's okay, Jason.
I don't know. Kids singing.
This is a tough one.
You have any idea, Anthony?
I think he was talking about his plan to bail out Detroit. and he wanted to give all of his heart and love to Detroit. Am I right about that? No?
That's a good guess, but that is not correct. This is a hard one. Did you even know this?
I had not even heard of this thing.
Okay, in less than a week after the new Pulse of the City art installations, heart-shaped structures that play tunes to the beat of people's pulses when they place their hands on them. They were set up in 5 locations around the city, and one was destroyed and another one was stolen.
Oh.
So that's why he said, they stole my hat.
So the way it works here is the hosts of the program don't even have to have a clue about the answer. I'm just
obviously,
curious. Because on Chronicle, the hosts actually know what's going on. I'm just saying.
I almost never know what's going on, Anthony. I'm just here for the ride.
That's beautiful. By the way, that was the voice of Anthony Everett. And the other voice you hear other than mine and Marjorie is J.C. Monahan, the new team on Chronicle on Channel 5. Now, here's your question, Anthony. You can jump into the lead. Here's a clip from Conan O'Brien, a local kid. We bleeped out the operative word. What is Conan talking about?
The new Secretary of the Vatican said that for priests is open for discussion.
Yeah.
In a related story, nuns are now allowed to twerk.
Pretty cute. What's open for discussion, Anthony Everett, please?
Being gay.
No, well, actually, that's...
That is, the Pope has
judges, we
weighed
have a real
in
issue
on that.
Here. I think we have to give it to him, do we? We do, even though that wasn't
the
answer.
Oh, I got a ding, ding, ding.
Celibacy was the answer. That's
what,
but
we got that?
No, we've never done this.
This has nothing to do with what he said.
Well, what did he say? Can we hear the sound again? This is being challenged by J.C. Monahan.
Absolutely.
Is that even a thing?
Go ahead.
The new Secretary of the Vatican said that for priests is open for discussion.
Yeah. In a related story, nuns are now allowed to twerk.
Now, judges, we have a protest, like a Bill Belichickian moment from J.C.
Monahan. The flag has been thrown.
Do we give him the points or do we not? Well, they're thinking about it. They're thinking.
They're thinking about it.
I'm going to offer a compromise.
What is it?
Not unlike John Kerry.
Yes.
I'm going to offer a compromise that I offered being gay or being straight.
Yes.
So being gay should be half a point.
Okay.
Right? Because I covered
one side of the whole issue.
Well, that's true.
The judges accept
judges.
That compromise. Yes, that's fine.
Okay.
That was a half a bell. I love
half
that.
Half a bell. Ready, JC?
Yes.
Identify the character in this clip and why he is in the news this week.
Hi, I'm Did you know that you have rights? The Constitution says you do, and so do I. I believe that until proven guilty, every man, woman, and child in this country is innocent. And that's why I fight for you, Albuquerque.
Better call
What? Do you know?
This is a hard one, too. JC's getting the hard question.
Well, it's a hard one until you know the answer. It's hard from the sound, it is.
Do you know, Anthony?
Can we hear it one more time? Yeah, can we hear it one more time?
Hi, I'm Did you know that you have rights? The Constitution says you do, and so do I. I believe that until proven guilty, every man, woman, and child in this country is innocent. And that's why I fight for you, Albuquerque.
Better call
Now, I'm going to give you a hint. That is from a television show, and it is a commercial done by a character on a very, very popular television show. And if neither of you know, would neither do, I'll give you one more hint. The character in question here is about to get his own show. We just learned a couple of days ago. That's all I'm going to say. Who is it?
The guy on Breaking Bad.
That is exactly right. The lawyer. That is right.
Well done. Bravo.
Saul Goodman, the lawyer in Breaking Bad, played by a guy named Bob Odenkirk.
Correct. Now, by the way, it's Better Call Saul, is it? I am hoping, I've known you both for a long time. I hope when I ask you, are you not only watching but loving Breaking Bad, you're both going to say yes. Are you going to say yes, Tracy?
My husband watches it.
Well, and I know your husband very, very well.
Sadly, you do.
For who, me or for, exactly,
well,
I know.
Both.
Exactly.
It goes both ways.
Thank you for that.
You're
He's
welcome.
A fabulous director I've worked with forever. Oh, no, you're not looking at me. No,
yeah, no,
tell,
I'm not.
Why? Because you don't like stories about chemistry professors become meth kingpins? What's the problem?
No, it's really not that. It's just that I have other obligations throughout my life. I cannot spend hours and hours and hours
watching.
In front of the television, but apparently you don't have quite
it's
as much.
It's a very feeble excuse.
But people are addicted to that show. I know Jim is, my
no
husband.
No pun intended.
It is, and Jim, not your husband, that would be me, it is spectacular. And you're not there yet. You've only watched a little piece of a little, you have to say something. This is
I
radio.
Have not,
Thank
no,
you.
I have not been watching Breaking Bad either. I feel as all these big TV series are passing me by.
I missed the whole Sopranos thing, too.
That's not true.
I did.
So what are you watching, Malcolm in the Middle? What do you watch, Anthony Everett? Really, what do you watch?
I'm a big Modern Family fan.
Oh, well, they're great. That's great.
Okay, so
there
you go.
That's a half hour. What else is going on?
I'm very busy.
Okay.
How about Homeland?
No, not yet.
No. The new season begins when?
Starts 29th at 9 o'clock, not that I'm counting. Now, one of the odd things is when you see people like you every night on television, you assume you know virtually everything about each other. Every show he said he didn't watch, you expressed surprise, J.C. Monahan. What's that about?
Because I do most of the talking, and he sits there, yes, and I tell him all my likes and dislikes. He's been making a chart, and, he hasn't offered up all that much. I must say, Anthony, you haven't offered up all that much.
Well, I'm keeping track of all of your stuff, right
now,
which is a lot.
It is
a lot. A lot of us are keeping track of
a lot
all
of
our
that.
Stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, he's the strong, silent type. Okay. A man of few words.
Now, here it is.
Okay,
here's the next question. This is for Anthony Everett, the man with whom we're just speaking. Here is Stephen Colbert, Anthony. Who is he talking about, and what act of leadership did this person recently do?
My friend here is a strong leader who has long inspired all of us with his manly courage. He's crossbowed a gray whale. He's tranquilized a polar bear. And folks, you want leadership? Recently, to train some birds who were raised in captivity, piloted a hang glider at the head of an endangered crane migration, donning white overalls to be recognized by the crane.
Who is Colbert talking about, and what act of leadership did this person recently undertake?
I'm going to go with, I like to call him Rootin' Tootin', Vladimir Putin.
That is exactly
I like that.
Rootin' Tootin' Putin. Yeah, the act of leadership obviously was offering to help this crisis in Syria by taking over or at least inspecting their stockpile.
You get all those
chemical
points,
weapons.
Actually. You do.
Oh, thank you very much.
You do. So before we go to the next round.
Big Colbert fan, by the way.
You are.
Colbert and Daily Show I watch every day.
Oh, Colbert's a riot.
They're both fantastic.
Just watching him flying in on that flag is hysterical.
So what? Before we go to the next round to relieve the tension in the room, like what hot do you guys have coming up in the near future, Anthony Everett?
I'm working on an aviation show, kind of all things aerial above Boston. We just rode in the Hood blimp not too long ago. We were down at Bridgewater State, which has the only collegiate aviation program in all of New England. Yeah.
How was the blimp?
It's interesting.
How was the blimp? Was that fun?
It was very
really
fun.
Scary?
Yeah, no, it's an odd sort of machine. I mean, it's this enormous balloon, basically, right, with this tiny little, not very sophisticated basket hanging off the bottom of it. But it was great to ride in it. Obviously, it's iconic in New England.
Is it noisy?
It's a little noisy, and the engines are nothing sophisticated. It's basically like a lawnmower engine with a propeller on it.
Oh.
But as the pilot said, and I love this because he turned the engines off at one point, he goes, if you do this in an airplane, you've got a fairly limited glide path, and then you're going to crash. With us, if we lose engines, you got about 15 minutes until you're going to crash. So you can think about it.
That's great.
So it's kind of like, oh, wait.
So what have you been working on, JC?
I have a couple of long-term projects. We are doing something very special with the Boston Marathon survivors and caregivers. And we also are following what Cape Cod Hospital is doing with drug-addicted babies. They're called NAS babies. And there is a big influx of moms on methadone or moms on street drugs or even prescription drugs who are having babies. And Cape Cod Hospital is really taking the lead in treating these babies in the first weeks and months of their lives.
Well, you don't think of the Cape having that much poverty, but there's a lot of poverty, year-round people that live down there.
I think that's a big surprise to a lot of people that it's Cape Cod. You hear about the bigger cities, but this is something that's really, really becoming a problem down on the Cape. But at least this hospital and Falmouth Hospital, well, really trying to get a grasp on it.
Yeah, I want to mention one more thing. Speaking of Chronicle, a buddy of mine is a colleague of yours, Ted Reinstein, who has written a fabulous book, which he was kind enough to give me a few months ago. New England Notebook, One Reporter, Six States, Uncommon Stories. It is real. I'm not into those kind of books at all. It is great. It is really a terrific piece of work.
It was so nice for me because I got him to sign my copy.
Oh, me too.
That was nice. Yeah. That was nice.
Yeah. Ted's a wonderful writer.
Yeah,
so
and it's a beautiful
it's
book.
Great.
Yes.
Okay, next
okay,
question
Ray
for J.C. and Margaret.
Yes.
Who was confirmed as Boston's newest billionaire this week?
There needs to be lunatics like me that still have that same passion. Nobody ages beer for 11 years. Nobody takes beer up to 52 proof. That, to me, is the fun of it. I feel like Willy Wonka of beer.
The Sam Adams guy?
Yes. Yes, correct.
Tim Cook. Can I tell you something? If you had the temerity to say that to him, you know what happened? You know what
oh,
he would
no.
say to you? He would glare at you and say, it is Samuel Adams. It is not. You ever had that experience, Anthony Everett? It is not Sam Adams.
No, I have met him, but I thought he was. I thought you were going to say he's going to say it's Jim Cook, not Sam Adams.
I don't know. When my husband asked me to pick it up, it's always pick me up some Sam.
Sam, yeah.
So there you
I
go.
I got it. You worked your husband in this
yeah,
conversation
really,
quite a bit.
Apparently,
I should
they're
say.
Drinking and watching Breaking Bad over there.
I have a
sounds
life.
Like a party at JC's house tonight.
Can wait to hear what the kids are doing. It's really wild. In
they're
any
serving.
Case, what's the score here, judges? We haven't been paying attention.
As,
who's got three?
As if that's different than every other show.
JC, you have three, and Anthony, you have a mere 2.5 points.
What, how
here's
is
your
that
chance.
Possible?
I don't know. Here's your chance to break into the lead. What new consumer product, it was just announced this week, is the subject of this spoof commercial?
The is in many ways what you have all been looking for. Sleek, efficient, and harmonious with design and technological intellect. As a senior VP of design, I know what you're thinking. This is the same shit you've seen over and over again. Well, you're right. I can't believe you guys keep buying our products. We haven't done anything new in like the past 6 years.
Okay, the question is, what's the new consumer product that is being ridiculed here, Anthony Everett?
I think whenever you don't know the answer, the best one to go with is the Shake Weight. So I'm going with Shake Weight.
By the way, even though that's wrong, I'd give him a half point for that.
Anthony,
thank you.
Perhaps
I'm
you could
sorry.
Describe the Shake Weight commercials.
It's really, you know, this is where TV is different than radio, Marjorie.
So true.
It's such a visual
Google
thing.
Google it.
You have
it
to
is
say.
A visual thing.
That happens to be wrong.
It,
do you know
get
what it
yourself
is?
Yourself a good laugh.
The iPhone?
That is the iPhone, and she jumps back into the lead. She gets the whole point. Now, here's the deal. We only have a few minutes left. Here's how the bonus round works. Since you two are the hosts of Chronicle, we're going to ask you about the 2012 sci-fi film entitled Chronicle. Exactly. Chronicle's about an alienated teen, as you both know, who chronicles his life with a handheld camera. He and two of his classmates encounter a mysterious force in the woods, which gives them superpowers. Some of them use their powers for good, others for evil, like revenge, sort of like the Blair Witch Project meets Carrie. First question for J.C. Monahan from Marjorie Egan.
Okay, ready, JC?
Sure.
Chronicle?
Sure.
These are multiple choice questions.
Fantastic.
Chronicle is set in Seattle, but for budget purposes was filmed in A, Sydney, Australia, B, Cape Town, South Africa, or C, Bucharest, Romania.
I can tell you what our answer is going to be. You know, when my husband was in Bucharest, Romania, a couple of months ago. No, but that's okay. What's the answer?
Those are the cheaper choices to Seattle?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. Well,
is Sydney, Australia, Cape Town, South Africa, or Bucharest, Romania? One of them was much cheaper than Seattle. Do you know which one?
Cape Town.
You are correct.
Woo-hoo!
Woo! That
Anthony
was brilliant.
Is not happy.
And Jim, man,
no, it's
brilliant. My husband and I
studied.
Have been there.
Have you really? I'm sure you have. Thank you.
I just
enough
did that to annoy
him.
You.
Okay. It did annoy me, actually. Now, Anthony Everett, here's your chance to do something. Tie it up or not tie it up. In the sci-fi film Chronicle, have either of you seen it, by the way?
Never even heard of it.
Yeah, I have seen it.
You have not?
No, I have.
Have you really?
I have. I
know
I
you laughed, you
it.
Cried, whatever. How did one of the characters, use his superpowers to kill someone? A, by flying his enemy up to the space needle and impaling him on it.
Ooh.
Oof, that hurts. Using telekinetic force, he breaks a cable off the floating bridge and strangles someone with the cable. Or C, he throws someone into a tank of Komodo dragons at the Woodland Zoo. Is it A, B, or C, Anthony Everett?
Well, there was a D, because they did knock a car with telekinetic powers off the road, as you may recall, early on in the movie.
Oh, of course I do, yes.
So there's a half extra point for that one.
Fine.
And I'm going to go with the impaling on the space needle. As
that is exactly correct. That is exactly correct. And sadly, I don't think we have enough time to read the final question. Do we, Marjorie?
I don't know.
No, we don't.
We don't. Oh,
so
thank
I
you.
Win. Thank
so
you very much,
score,
everybody. Good night.
Please. What is the score? Who won this match? Can
no
you tell
way
us, please?
Is it him.
Four, JC, you have 5 points. Now, let me ask you something.
She was in a fight mood coming in here today, and she's prevailed.
Now, how is it going to affect your relationship, such as it is? Because you do this show every night, 7:30 on Channel 5. How do you think it's going to affect your relationship, Anthony, that the new kid, she's only been there since May, won this particular contest?
Well, if I think had the questions been less about drinking and crystal meth, I would have done better. So I think that explains
it all. So it's unfair.
A little bit is what I'm saying. Obviously, there was some research done by your staff ahead of time, and it was all fixed.
Now, J.C. Money, you have 10 seconds to lord it over Anthony Everett.
Well, he's all bitter because I smoked him in the Demolition Derby.
You did?
Yeah. Did you see it?
No, I didn't see that one.
Circles around the man.
Oh, that's really sad.
One person left in an ambulance, and one person walked away.
That's because I take risks,
Anthony. I will leave it at that.
The great Anthony Everett and J.C. Monahan, co-hosts of a terrific show, Chronicle, Channel 5, 7:30 every weeknight. Great to see you both. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Terrific.
Okay, this is the end of the show today.
It is the end of the show.
I thank everybody for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I want to thank Amanda, Will, and Chelsea for another great week here on Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for
and Alan engineered today's show. Don't forget.
Alan. Hi, Alan. Missed Alan. Tune in Monday for an update on local and national politics with former State Treasurer Shannon O'Brien and Republican State Senator Bob Heflin. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browder. Have a great weekend. Bye.
See you Monday.